Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Finally today, I'd like to take a few minutes to remember Chicago psychiatrist Dr. Carl Bell. He died a little over 2 weeks ago, on Friday, August 2nd, at the age of 71. Under the usual conventions of journalism, we would have acknowledged this right away, but you know what happened. There were mass shootings that weekend in the span of just a few hours in El Paso and Dayton, less well publicized in his hometown, Chicago. 32 separate shooting incidents that weekend left 7 people dead and 52 injured. I didn't talk about him then because, frankly, I just didn't have the bandwidth. But I want to acknowledge Dr. Bell now because so much of his work and his mission centered on something that concerns all of us, and that is violence, trying to understand the causes of violence and to treat the consequences of it, all of it, in the home, between gangs, bias crimes, street violence. He cared about all of it, and significantly, he cared about everyone, both the victims and the perpetrators, who were, he constantly reminded us, often interchangeable. He was obviously a person of deep empathy. Born and raised in Chicago, after medical school in Tennessee and a stint in the Navy, he returned to Chicago to practice. According to articles I read, he was always aware of the violence in his surroundings. But as a young doctor, his life's work was profoundly affected by treating a child whose mother had been killed in front of him. He had a remarkably full portfolio. Along with seeing patients, he was a prolific researcher and writer. It was because of this scholarly work that I first met Dr. Bell, and it's depressing to remember this, reporting on another racially motivated mass shooting, one that took place in August 1999, when Buford Furrow Jr. shot and wounded 5 people at a Jewish community center and then killed a Filipino-American postal worker. By 2001, when Furrow agreed to a life sentence to avoid the death penalty, it was clear that he was a white supremacist who set out to hurt Jews and brown people. But it was also clear that he was mentally ill. At the time, one of Dr. Bell's projects was researching the question of whether such extreme racism is itself a form of mental illness. After that first conversation, I found myself seeking him out at least once or twice a year to comment on issues related to mental health. Dr. Bell was a great source because he could explain complicated ideas in a way that anybody could understand. If your image of a psychiatrist is a bearded German man with tortoiseshell glasses, then you would have been quite surprised. He was a brown-skinned African-American, wiry from years of practice of martial arts, with a smoky voice that would have been at home hosting an NPR jazz program. I imagine his patients found him quite comforting. But as a scholar, he thought it was important to address questions with great seriousness and precision. Thus, although he wrote a chapter about it for the Oxford Handbook of Personality Disorders, he never did tell me whether extreme racism is on its face a mental illness because, he said, the science is not strong enough yet. Can I just tell you, here's why I feel it's so important to talk about him and his work now. In 2012, the Southside Community Mental Health Council he started closed after 37 years for lack of funding. On the days following its closure, he sat outside in his car with a laptop, files, and a prescription pad, waiting for patients who might not have gotten word so he could greet them and try to help them get their meds and find other resources. Mental illness is crushing many of us, and violence, particularly gun violence, is killing many of us. Dr. Bell spent his entire career trying both to answer the question of why and to repair the damage caused by our ignorance. It seems the least we can do is try to finish what he started on the south side of Chicago and everywhere else.
California knows how to But we start today in Sacramento. California now has some of the strictest rules for when police officers can use deadly force. Now, the new law comes by way of a bill signed this afternoon by Governor Gavin Newsom. The measure comes months after negotiations with law enforcement groups. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler was at the signing. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Now, the bill we're talking about is AB 392. What changes for law enforcement are in now that it's signed into law?
Well, this all boils down to two words, necessary and reasonable, and how you define them. So right now, deadly force is justified in California if a reasonable officer would have acted similarly in that situation. In other words, that's what a typical officer would do based on his or her training. When the law takes effect in January, that standard will change to when the officer reasonably believes deadly force is necessary, the key word being necessary, although the measure leaves interpretation of how to define it up to the legal system to figure out by a case-by-case basis. There are a couple other parts of this deal worth noting. The officer's conduct leading up to the shooting will be considered, as will the suspect's behavior. And there is language in the bill that allows police to use other alternatives, de-escalation, less lethal options, before using deadly force, but these requirements are a statement of intent, not a specific checklist.
And this legislation, born out of the shooting death of Stephon Clark, he was shot by Sacramento police last year. Did that incident kind of provide the bill with added fuel as it worked its way through the legislature?
Absolutely. Although there were, you know, it did take some time for this all to get through. So the bill was introduced after last spring's shooting of Clark. And it gained momentum, but nobody really seemed able to reach consensus or any sort of compromise. And so late last year, just before the legislature adjourned, Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins sidelined the bill. And she said, look, you know, this isn't ready. And I want both sides to sit down while the legislature is in recess and work through into a deal. Then early this year, the talks broke down and the different bills moved. There were a couple of different bills, one backed by law enforcement and this measure, and they both worked through the legislative process. And as they were going through the process in March of this year, in separate investigations, Sacramento County District Attorney's Office and California Attorney General Javier Becerra each announced they would not be charging the police officers who shot Clark. And that really did, I think, help spur changes, spur this bill across the finish line. And yet, you know, neither side really got everything they wanted in it, even with the Clark shooting and the decision not to prosecute.
Now, while this bill was being debated, the law enforcement organization said the bill's language endangers officers, that regulations maybe could cause them to second guess themselves in the field. Ben, did law enforcement groups eventually come around, and how are they feeling today after its signing?
So they moved from opposed to neutral on this bill because of some of the compromise terms I laid out. They are also backing a separate bill, which I think we're going to get into a little bit later, but it deals with training for officers. And there's money in the state budget also for that training. And so all of that combined moved them to neutral. And I think the point was that both sides realized they did not have the votes on their own to get what they wanted without reaching some sort of consensus. So last week, I spoke with California Police Chiefs Association President Ronald Lawrence, who's the chief of police for the Sacramento suburb of Citrus Heights. And he says the most important thing moving forward is for officers and the communities they police to build trust.
How do we, you know, put aside the emotion, put aside all of the discussions at the Capitol? How can we get to a point where we start to build that trust again?
There is still that trust to be built.
Yeah. Now, okay, so meanwhile, activist groups, some of them had lobbied for the bill, ended up dropping their support, saying that too many changes were made to satisfy law enforcement. What are you hearing from civil rights activists today?
There is a bit of a split, and so let's hear from a couple. And I should say the split isn't all that surprising, considering that as I said, everyone had to compromise to reach a deal. So I've got two cuts queued up here. The first is from Stephon Clark's brother, Stevante, and he says slow progress is better than no progress.
I call this the Stephon Clark law. You know, I don't think this law would be here and as powerful as it is now if it wasn't for my brother.
But Sacramento community activist Barry Axia says even though he fought hard to get this bill signed, he is not as optimistic as others are about how it will be executed.
Is it really going to be an action bill, a bill that makes sense, a bill that will actually hold these officers accountable?
And until Axia says officers are held to the same standards as everyone else, in his mind, this will still be an open question.
And looking ahead a bit, Ben, there's another bill backed by law enforcement that might have been seen as a companion bill to the law that was passed today. That one is SB 230. It would order the state's police training commission to develop new use of force guidelines. That bill passed the Senate, now is in the Assembly. What would that bill change, and where does that one stand now?
So to say where it stands right now, it is hung up in the Assembly. It didn't need to be. My understanding is that everyone was willing to move it forward, except perhaps the chairwoman of the Assembly Appropriations Committee, Lorena Gonzalez, who I believe wants the bill to go through the full process along with everything else. And it will. Governor Newsom reiterated today he expects that bill to reach him and he expects to sign it. And that was kind of a little, I don't know if it was sending a message or not, but it was making clear to everyone that this is part of the deal and it is going to get through. As for what it will change, you know, there's some disagreement about that. Backers of the law signed today, the legal standard law, say, you know, this bill isn't important. We're not concerned with it. We are focused on the legal standard. Law enforcement groups argue, look, we have these new legal standards. We need to train officers in them. And now there's money behind that training in the state budget. And if you raise the standard and you train, then that standard of how would a reasonable officer act? Would a reasonable officer perceive that deadly force is necessary? Well, if the reasonable standard is raised higher for officers, law enforcement argues that that would also help go a long way to reduce the use of deadly force, and potentially, if an officer acts out, inappropriately, would make it more viable for them to be charged.
You mentioned, Ben, that AB 392 will go into effect January 1st of 2020, and I guess on all sides, everyone's hoping that any of this will save lives, will prevent lives from being lost. What is the hope that you've heard that this will do that, that it'll accomplish what it sets out to do?
It is a hope, but it is also a trust and verify, especially from everyone from even Gavin Newsom acknowledged it as he signed the law, saying, you know, look, we'll miss this moment if we just call this a victory all by itself. Certainly heard that from the bill's author, Dr. Weber, the assembly member from San Diego. And you heard it from activists, including Barry Axias, who we just heard from. And on the law enforcement side, I think they know that they need to build trust. And I think, look, I mean, nobody is hoping there's going to be more deaths, and everyone's hoping that this will do something. So we'll see.
Ben Adler is Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio. Ben, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I want to be a cop.
What does justice look like 5 years after Eric Garner's death? Garner is the unarmed black man who died after a white New York police officer put him in a chokehold. Garner could be heard on video begging police not to touch him and saying, over and over, "I can't breathe." Yesterday, that police officer, Daniel Pantaleo, was fired. But Eric Garner's family says their fight goes on. His daughter, Emerald Garner, joins me on the line from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking your reaction to the decision by Police Commissioner James O'Neill to fire Daniel Pantaleo. I saw that you thanked him for, in your words, doing the right thing. Tell me what you meant.
Well, my thanking him had a lot to do with the fact that we've had a grand jury and we've had the Department of Justice and we've had different avenues step in to make a decision as to whether Pantaleo was wrong in what he actually did to Eric Garner. So when I say thank you, I mean thank you for making the right choice and making the decision and showing us that you saw what we saw.
Do you feel bitterness that this took 5 years before the decision was made to fire Pantaleo?
You know, I felt a lot of frustration over the last 5 years. I felt a lot of anger knowing that my tax dollars was paying the murderer of my father, and to ultimately have him fired from the police department and, you know, possibly reopening the case and bringing up the congressional hearing, that's what's bringing me a sense of relief.
So I saw your grandmother, Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, quoted as saying the fight is not over. What is that fight now that Pantaleo's been fired?
The Eric Garner law is something that, you know, we're definitely pushing towards because that would basically solidify that the chokehold is illegal. Right now, the chokehold is banned in New York City, and banned and illegal are definitely two different things. And when something becomes illegal, when you do it, you're going to be, like, prosecuted no matter what.
So just to make sure that people are following here, you're explaining that the chokehold is banned by New York police policy. It is not banned by New York law, and that is what the Eric Garner law that you would like to see passed would do?
Yes.
Hmm. I want to ask you about something that the president of the New York Police Union, this is Patrick Lynch, said following the news that Pantaleo had been fired. Lynch says that was the wrong move, that Pantaleo should not have been fired, that it was Police Commissioner O'Neill who should go. Let me play just a little bit of Mr. Lynch speaking yesterday, and he was speaking, I should say, straight to the commissioner.
You sent this out. You made the policy. Quit or be fired. Not Officer Pantaleo. We were following the rules of the police department and the instructions from the chief of department's office.
Emerald Garner, to that, what do you say? What's your reaction?
I think the police union is very upset, and they can be upset because I've been upset for the past 5 years, and they crossed the line. And when you cross the line, you have to be penalized for your actions.
May I just, understanding that nothing brings your dad back, a law with his name on it would be quite something. And I wonder if you would just speak to a moment to what that would mean to you and to your family.
For me, that would mean that there would never be another Eric Garner. Another family would never have to go through what we go through. I don't expect for another officer to kill an unarmed black man, but that's like kind of the norm of what we live in right now. Like every time you pick up your phone or you look on the TV, there's another one of us dying at the hands of the police. So if we can have a law where a police officer would say, you know, I'm not going to be reckless and I'm not going to cross the line with a civilian, you know, that's when people will realize when I do things, consequences happen to me, whether I have a shield or not.
That's Emerald Garner speaking to us from New York. Her father, Eric Garner, died in 2014. Emerald Garner, thank you very much for your time, and I am sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you for having me.
And I want to start by playing an extended excerpt from Police Commissioner O'Neill's announcement of that. You've been hearing some sound bites on the news as newscast formats permit, but O'Neill took more than 3 minutes to lay out his full line of reasoning regarding Officer Pantaleo's chokehold and when it crossed the line into a fireable offense. So we're going to take advantage of our long form format here and give you that whole thing now. And spoiler alert, this has to do less with that there was a chokehold and more with how long he held it there. So to begin this discussion, here are 3 minutes and 12 seconds of Commissioner James O'Neill.
For several minutes on that widely viewed video, Mr. Garner makes it abundantly clear that he will not go willingly with the police officers. He refused to cooperate with the arrest and to comply with lawful orders. The video also makes clear that Officer Pantaleo's original efforts to take Mr. Garner into custody were appropriate and that he initially attempted two maneuvers sanctioned by the police department. Officer Pantaleo first grabbed Mr. Garner's right wrist and attempted an armbar technique in preparation for handcuffs to be used. Mr. Garner immediately twisted and pulled and raised both of his hands while repeatedly telling the officers to not touch him. Officer Pantaleo then wrapped his arms around Mr. Garner's upper body. Up to that point in this tense and rapidly evolving situation, there was nothing to suggest that Officer Pantaleo attempted to place Mr. Garner in a chokehold. But what happened next is the matter we must address. The two men stumbled backward towards the large plate glass window, the storefront behind them, and Officer Pantaleo's back made contact with the glass, causing the window to visibly buckle and warp. The person videotaping the episode later testified at the NYPD trial that he thought both men would crash through the glass. It is at that point in the video that Officer Pantaleo is seen with his hands clasped together and his left forearm pressed against Mr. Garner's neck in what constitutes a chokehold. The NYPD court ruled that while certainly not preferable, that hold was acceptable during that brief moment in time because the risk of falling through the window was so high. But that exigent circumstance no longer existed, the court found, when Officer Pantaleo and Mr. Garner moved to the ground. As Mr. Garner balanced himself on the sidewalk on his hands and knees, Deputy Commissioner of Trials Rosemarie Maldonado found that Officer Pantaleo consciously disregarded the substantial and unjustifiable risk of maneuver explicitly prohibited by the department. She found that during the struggle, Officer Pantaleo had the opportunity to readjust his grip from a prohibited chokehold to a less lethal alternative, but did not make use of that opportunity. Instead, even once Mr. Garner was moved to his side on the ground, with his left arm behind his back and his right hand still open and extended, Officer Pantaleo kept his hands clasped and maintained the chokehold. Mr. Garner's obvious distress is confirmed when he coughs and grimaces. Moreover, Trials Commissioner Maldonado found that Officer Pantaleo's conduct caused physical injury that meets the penal law threshold and that his recklessness caused multi-layered internal bruising and hemorrhaging that impaired Mr. Garner's physical condition and caused substantial pain and was a significant factor in triggering an asthma attack. For all of these reasons, taken together, even after reviewing Officer Pantaleo's commendable service record of nearly 300 arrests and 14 department medals earned leading up to that day, Trial Commissioner Maldonado recommended that he be dismissed from the department.
Commissioner James O'Neill from the NYPD yesterday, and I thought you deserved to hear, and he deserved for you to hear, that full 3 minutes and 12 seconds of how he saw the sequence of events that included the chokehold, as he characterized it, by Officer Pantaleo. Joining me now are two reporters who have been covering this, WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez and New York Times reporter Ashley Southall. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Brian.
And Ashley, thank you so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Cindy, was it a surprise to you at all that Commissioner laid out in that clip how it was not the application of the chokehold? It wasn't a binary yes or no, is this a banned chokehold or not, but the way that Officer Pantaleo maintained it?
I think that it wasn't so surprising, but what was surprising, I think, was the emotion that he displayed throughout that press conference and his desire to want to empathize with the officers, particularly Officer Pantaleo. At one point, he said, "Had I been in that same situation, I may have made the same mistakes that Officer Pantaleo made. And had I made those same mistakes, I would today be wishing that I had waited for backup. I would be wishing that I had let go."
Ashley, same question. Was that new to you in your experience covering this story, that the issue became not that there was a chokehold, but how long it was applied after Mr. Garner was subdued?
No, because in her rationale, that Judge Maldonado notes that once Pantaleo and Mr. Garner hit the ground, that the circumstances change. And that's very important to Commissioner O'Neill's main audience, which is not necessarily the public, but his police officers. He has to be very careful to explain why Daniel Pantaleo is being fired, what he did wrong, because he needs officers to understand the very specific nature of those circumstances and how they have to be careful, but at the same time, he has their back.
So since you both brought this up, how agonizing this decision appeared to be for Commissioner O'Neill, I know his voice was wavering at times, and how he's got multiple constituencies here, to look at it in political terms, the public around the city, the police officers themselves, the truth, as he sees it, is another constituency. But I'm going to play another 2.5-minute clip of the commissioner. And again, listeners, if you've heard sound bites, you'll get to hear in extended form here just how much the commissioner did agonize over this decision, just how much he wanted to give credit to police officers in general for the difficulty of their work, and even to Officer Pantaleo for what other things he's done in his career, but also to acknowledge, as he ultimately had to conclude one way or the other, that this was a fireable offense, and hope that he could bring the city together around the complex way that he laid it out. So once again, Commissioner James O'Neill.
The street is never the right place to argue the appropriateness of an arrest. That is what our courts are for. Being a police officer is one of the hardest jobs in the world. That is not a statement to elicit sympathy from those we served. It's a fact. Cops have to make choices, sometimes very quickly, every single day. Some are split-second life and death choices. Oftentimes, they are choices that will be thoroughly and repeatedly examined by those with much more time to think about them than the police officer had. And those decisions are scrutinized and second-guessed, both fairly and unfairly. No one believes that Officer Pantaleo got out of bed on July 17, 2014, thinking he would make choices and take actions during an otherwise routine arrest that would lead to another person's death. But an officer's choices and actions, even made under extreme pressure, matter. It is unlikely that Mr. Garner thought he was in such poor health that a brief struggle with the police would cause his death. He should have decided against resisting arrest, but a man with family lost his life, and that is an irreversible tragedy. And a hardworking police officer with a family, a man who took this job to do good, to make a difference in his home community, has now lost his chosen career. And that is a different kind of tragedy. In this case, the unintended consequence of Mr. Garner's death must have a consequence of its own. Therefore, I agree with the Deputy Commissioner of Trials' legal findings and recommendations. It is clear that Daniel Pantaleo can no longer effectively serve as a New York City police officer. In carrying out the court's verdict in this case, I take no pleasure. I know that many will disagree with this decision, and that is their right. There are absolutely no victors here today, not the Garner family, not the community at large, and certainly not the courageous men and women of the police department who put their own lives on the line every single day in service and to the people of this great city. Today is a day of reckoning, but can also be a day of reconciliation. We must move forward together as one city, determined to secure safety for all New Yorkers, and safety for every police officer working daily to protect all of us.
That was just about the last 2.5 minutes of Commissioner O'Neill's statement yesterday. Still with us, WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez and New York Times correspondent Ashley Southall, who have both been covering the story, and reporter Ashley Southall from the New York Times. Explain to our listeners for a minute how Judge Maldonado, in the decision that was somehow leaked to you, said not just Pantaleo used this chokehold, Pantaleo was untruthful. And maybe other officers on the scene were untruthful. What did the judge say about that?
Well, she said that, you know, there was nothing else for her to conclude from. In Pantaleo's internal affairs interview, which came a few days after the grand jury in Staten Island decided not to bring charges against him, he explains what a chokehold is. He describes basically choking someone with your arms around his neck, and then the investigators ask him to read the broader definition in the patrol guide, and then they show him the video of him with Eric Garner on the ground. His left arm is around Eric Garner's neck, and his two hands are clasped. And he still says that he did not use a chokehold. And she found that implausible in the face of the video and also the several layers of hemorrhaging in Eric Garner's neck that could not have come from just choking. It evidenced that there was force applied to his neck. And she further goes on to show that Mr. Garner on the ground was signaling his distress when he put his hand out and then later when he coughed and grimaced, and yet Pantaleo held on. So she found his explanation that his arm was protecting Mr. Garner's neck, that's what he said, to be implausible. And then for the other officer, she also thought that the more the questions got to the central issue of whether Pantaleo used a chokehold, the hazier their recollections became. And she seemed to think that this was more than coincidental, that might be intentional. But she doesn't go as far as saying that in her opinion. Mm-hmm. I did ask Commissioner O'Neill yesterday what he thought about that, and he said that he didn't expect officers to remember something 5 years later. But it was clear from Judge Maldonado's opinion that she thought that this was more than memory lost to time.
Right. With respect to officers on the scene, Mark Ramos and Craig Furlani, oh, they didn't see, they weren't looking, they weren't thinking about it, they weren't focusing on it, and the judge concluded, as you just quoted her, the more central the factual inquiry was, the more vague recollections became.
The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher.
There's a lot of debate and controversy over how law enforcement uses facial recognition technology. The FBI says it's an important investigative tool. Take the case of Walter Yovani Gomez.
One of America's most wanted criminals, a fugitive and alleged member of the vicious MS-13 gang, now captured.
Captured in part because of facial recognition. NPR Justice reporter Ryan Lucas explains how it all went down.
Back in 2011, Walter Yovani Gomez wanted to become a full member of the local branch of the MS-13 street gang in Plainfield, New Jersey. In May of that year, he got his chance. Gang leaders ordered him to kill a recruit named Julio Matute, who had allegedly been associating with a rival gang. And so after a night of partying with Matute, Gomez and an associate beat him with a baseball bat, stabbed him with a screwdriver, and slit his throat. Police closed in on Gomez in 2011, but he jumped out of a second-story window and escaped. For 6 years, his trail went cold. Then in April of 2017, the FBI made an announcement that put Gomez in the national crime spotlight.
A violent gang member is the newest addition to the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list. An up to $100,000 reward is available for information leading directly to the arrest of Walter Yovani Gomez.
The move quickly paid off. A tipster came forward that July claiming to have information on Gomez. It fell to Special Agent Richard Stallings in the FBI's Washington field office to follow up. So Stallings and a gang task force colleague arranged a face-to-face meeting with the tipster. They wanted to vet the source and make sure, as Stallings puts it, they weren't running up a dead tree. They quickly determined that they were not.
He truly was like, I know that guy. He says, I don't know him by the name that's on the screen, Gomez, but he knew him on a different name.
The tipster pointed the FBI to Facebook pages with photos of the man he believed was Gomez. Agents pulled the photos and sent them to the Bureau's Face Services Unit. There, they were run through an FBI database using facial recognition software in search of a match. About a week later, a match came back, but for Jesus Lopez Centurreo. Centurreo had been picked up for marijuana possession in 2014 after jumping a metro turnstile in Arlington, Virginia. His fingerprints and mugshot were taken, and then he was released. Centurreo had then failed to appear for his court date, so there was a warrant out for his arrest.
We were kind of baffled in how we got this name associated with our picture, but then the picture they had that they associated with in the arrest photo, and like, that's our guy.
Investigators still felt the tipster's information was solid. In part, Stallings says, because there were other physical identifiers, like tattoos, that made them think they were on the right track. They also had leads to work. Remember those Facebook pages the tipster provided? Agents also found several photos of the suspect with a female associate. Agents used facial recognition software to run the Facebook photos of her through a database of criminal mugshots. They came back with a match and an address. So the FBI and officers from the Fairfax County Gang Task Force set up surveillance on her. One afternoon in August 2017, officers set up a stakeout outside her residence.
A couple hours later, I get this call back from their sergeant. We got our guy. I was like, what? And I said, no, it's our guy. And, you know, first thing in my mind, are you sure? Because we didn't know for sure he was here at any point.
The agents had tailed the woman to a gym parking lot in Woodbridge, Virginia, about 20 miles south of Washington, D.C. And who walks up to her car but a man who looked a lot like Gomez? Their surveillance team swooped in and arrested him, but there was a twist. The sergeant on the phone said the man gave his name as Jesus Lopez Centurreo, the same name that the FBI turned up in its facial recognition search. But when confronted with the evidence investigators had collected, the man said that his real name was, in fact, Walter Yovani Gomez.
So in showing him actually his top 10 most wanted poster and being asked, is this you? He says, yes.
Since that night, Gomez has pleaded guilty to a racketeering conspiracy and admitted to Matute's murder. Last month, a federal judge in New Jersey sentenced him to 25 years in prison. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Black babies cost less.
A Wynn woman accused of pointing a gun at four teenagers who were selling discount cards will appear in court at the end of next month. Sheriff David West there says Jerry Kelly's husband, who is the jail administrator, resigned 4 days after that arrest. Fox 13's Jackie Massey is live with more on this story. Jackie?
The sheriff tells me that the jail administrator resigned because he was receiving threats. And this happened 4 days after his wife, Jerry Kelly, was arrested, then bonded out of jail for $500. Jerry Kelly and her husband have moved out. It's the home where police say Kelly pointed a gun at four teenagers trying to sell discount cards. On August 7th, officers say they found the teens lying on the ground with Kelly standing over them off Morningside Drive. A grandparent of one of the teens tells me she's trying to find him a therapist. I spoke to her last week.
She put the gun right at my head. He said, I made peace with God that if I die, that I make it to heaven.
Last Monday, Kelly was arrested for four counts of aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and endangering the welfare of a minor. Sheriff David West tells me 4 days after Kelly's arrest, her husband Joe, the prison administrator, resigned. Many in the community questioned why her mugshot was never taken, but the sheriff explains it's because Kelly had a medical issue when she was booked in. A parent of one of the teens tells me he is not convinced.
That this type of stuff is going on and it is alive and well where we live, and it needs to stop.
Jerry Kelly will appear in court on September 30th at 9 a.m. I reached out to her attorney, but I did not hear back. Reporting live, Jackie Massey, Fox 13 News.
Ivy's brother used to sing this when he came in from the tobacco fields. Mama, is Master gonna sell us tomorrow? Yes, yes, yes.
Today, the New York Times published the print edition of the 1619 Project. The name marks this month's 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved people brought from Africa to the then Virginia colony. The Times says the project aims to reframe the country's history, understanding 1619 as our true founding, and placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. The project is led by New York Times Magazine reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is the author of the opening essay. She joins me now. You have been working on this for a number of years, but you put this together very quickly. First of all, why? Why this topic? Why this issue?
Well, you don't have very many opportunities to ever celebrate the 400th anniversary of anything. Mm. And it seemed to me that this was a great opportunity to really, as you said in your opening, reframe the way that we have thought about an institution that has impacted almost everything in modern American society, but that we're taught very little about, that we're often taught is marginal to the American story. And we wanted to do something different. We wanted to use the platform of the Times to force us to confront the reality of what slavery has meant for our development as a nation.
And this isn't just about sort of the kind of textbook ideas of what happened to slaves. You've got essays in here about health care, about geography, about sugar, about music, all of these different ripple effects that happen throughout the economy and really life here. You say in a sentence, you said, you know, we would not be the United States were it not for slavery. This is kind of one of the original fibers that made this country.
Absolutely. The conceit of the magazine is that one of the things we hear all the time is, well, that was in the past. Why do you have to keep talking about the past? Well, one, I think the past is clearly instructive for the how we are right now. Mm-hmm. But also, the conceit of the magazine is that you can look at all of these modern phenomena that you think are unrelated to slavery at all, and we were going to show you how they are. And so we have a story in there about traffic patterns. We have a story about why we're the only Western industrial country without universal health care, about why Americans consume so much sugar, about capitalism, about democracy. We're really trying to change the way that Americans are thinking that this was just a problem of the past that we've resolved and show that it isn't. What many people don't know, and I point this out in my essay, is that one of the reasons we even decide to become a nation in the first place is over the issue of slavery. And had we not had slavery, we might be Canada. Mm. That one of the reasons that the founders wanted to break off from Britain is they were afraid that Britain was going to begin regulating slavery and maybe even moving towards abolishment. And we were making so much money off of slavery that the founders wanted to be able to continue it. We're not taught that when we're taught about our origin stories. And not knowing that then really does not allow us to grapple with the nation that we really are and not just the nation that we're taught in kind of American mythology.
And that money ends up fueling so much more of what made this country.
Of course. It's not incidental that 10 of the first 12 presidents of the United States were slave owners. This is where, at that time, this kind of very burgeoning nation was getting so much of its wealth and its power. It's what allows this kind of ragged group of colonists to believe that they could defeat the most powerful empire in the world at that time. And it went everywhere. It was north and south. We talk about the Industrial Revolution. Where do Americans believe that the cotton that was being spun in those textile company or textile mills coming from? It was coming from enslaved people who were growing that cotton in the South. The rum industry, which was really, rum was the currency of the slave trade. That rum was being processed and sold in the United States. The banking industry that rises in New York City is rising largely to provide the mortgages and the insurance policies and to finance the slave trade. The shipbuilders, our northern shipbuilders, the people who are sending voyages to Africa to bring enslaved people here, are all in the north. So this was a truly national enterprise. But we prefer to think that it was just some backward southerners, because that is the way that we can kind of deal with our fundamental paradox at our beginning, that we were a nation built on both the inalienable rights of man and also a nation built on bondage.
Yeah, and you even talk about Wall Street's name comes from something that most of us don't recognize.
Absolutely. So Wall Street is called Wall Street because it was on that wall that enslaved people were bought and sold. That's been completely erased from our national memory and completely erased from the way that we think about the North. At the time of the Civil War, New York City's mayor actually threatened to secede from the Union with the South because so much money was being made off of slave-produced cotton that was being exported out of New York City. It is that erasure, I think, that has prevented us from really grappling with our history and so much in modern society that we see that is still related to that.
You talked about how basically the black American or just the black experience has been inconvenient to the narrative of this nation in all of these different categories, that it's been something that we have struggled to deal with, but oftentimes just not dealt with it as a result, that it was thorny.
Absolutely. So when you think about the story of who we are, that we are this country built on individual rights. We are the country where if you are coming from a place where you are not free, you can come to our shores and you can get freedom. Well, then you have black people. And every time you look at black Americans, you have to be reminded that there was 1/5 of our population who had no rights, no liberties, no freedom whatsoever. We are the constant reminder of really the lie at our origins, that while Thomas Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence, his enslaved brother-in-law was there to serve him and make sure that he's comfortable. So I think this explains a lot the continued perception that black people are a problem, that black people are, as Abraham Lincoln said, a troublesome presence in American democracy, because every time you see us, you have to be reminded of our original sin. And no one wants to be reminded of sin. We're ashamed of sin.
You talk in eloquent terms about how black people were really the perfecters of this democracy, that we had these original documents, but really it took this all the way almost to the civil rights struggle for us to start seeing what those words actually meant.
Absolutely. What I argue is that no one values freedom more than those who never had it. And so while the founders were writing these lofty and aspirational words, even as they knew that they were going to continue a system of slavery, black people had no choice but to believe in the literal interpretation of those words, that all men are created equal and are born with inalienable rights. And so black people, really from the moment we landed on these shores, have been resisting and trying to push the society towards a more equal society of universal rights. And that has really been our role. You can look at, you know, the fact that black people have fought in every single war this country has ever fought, but we've also engaged in a 250-year internal war against our own country to try to force our country to also bring full democracy here and not just abroad.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
You know, the fact that black people have fought in every single war this country has ever fought, but we've also engaged in a 250-year internal war against our own country to try to force our country to also bring full democracy here and not just abroad.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
So right now we will talk to one of the Times journalists about her piece in the 1916 package. Is Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board, who has been with the paper since 2006, largely covering health, And to that point, her article is called "Why Doesn't the United States Have Universal Health Care? The Answer Has Everything to Do with Race." Janine, thanks so much for joining us for this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your article begins with a story about smallpox in the post-Civil War South. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So at the close of the Civil War, the newly emancipated were dying basically in droves for want of basic necessities. You know, they didn't have enough food. They didn't have humane shelters. They didn't have enough clothing. And they also didn't have enough medical care. So smallpox was a problem that, you know, America knew about. We knew how to treat it. They hadn't discovered viruses quite yet, but they knew that quarantine was a good way to prevent spread. They knew that humane living conditions, having sanitary housing, was a way to increase spread, and they knew that vaccination could work. And so during the war, there was a small outbreak among the Confederate soldiers, and I think maybe even the Northern soldiers, and they applied those tools to stop the outbreak from becoming a widespread epidemic. When the same virus hit the newly emancipated communities, they did not employ those tools, and they allowed the disease to kind of spread and become much worse than it needed to be.
And you relate that to a general ambivalence that was attributed to white leaders at the time about African-American health in general. And you cite historian Jim Downs and his book, Sick from Freedom. What was that ambivalence?
So the ambivalence was, and this goes back to before the Civil War, you know, throughout the era of slavery, which was white slaveholders wanted black people to be healthy enough to work the plantations. That was their definition of black health. They, once the slaves were freed, they worried about them being so healthy that they could upend the racial hierarchy. So they wanted them healthy enough to return to the plantations even after slavery, and they wanted them, their communities, healthy enough that diseases wouldn't spread from black communities into white ones, but they did not necessarily want them so healthy that they would become a political force or a social force. So there was this deep ambivalence, you know, just down to the very core of American policy, and that echoed, you know, throughout.
That ambivalence, as Jim Downs describes it, suggests almost a conspiracy to keep African Americans unhealthy so they couldn't compete for work or political representation. Does that ring true to you, as opposed to like just a fundamental devaluing of black people's health, part of devaluing black people's basic humanity, and an unwillingness to spend money on it?
I think it's both of those things at the same time. And, you know, I think one of the things that reflects the ambivalence particularly strongly is this concept that emerges of extinction. So they explained this ambivalence to themselves, not as a matter of racism, but as, you know, through these fallacies of racial difference. And the height of that fallacy was, as the black communities were sick and they were dying, I think their mortality rate of newly emancipated black people was like 20 times that of white communities at the same time in the South. And as the death tolls were rising and bodies were literally clogging some of the streets in some of the cities, they explained that to themselves as a matter of biological inferiority. So it wasn't that the refugee camps they were forced to live in were near pits of open sewage. It wasn't that they didn't have enough nutrition. It wasn't that we weren't vaccinating them or providing them with proper medical care. It was that they were biologically inferior and basically, you know, allergic to freedom. And so they were dying off. And so there were these fervent arguments in Congress from the former slave states saying to provide any care or assistance to these people is wasteful and stupid because this is a natural biological process and they're just going to go extinct and it would be stupid to try to stop this. And that's how deep that, you know, that kind of understanding ran.
My guest is Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board and a contributor to their 1619 project, which observes that this year is the 400th anniversary of the first African people brought to the United States in slavery and the implications of that to this day. Her article focuses on health care and why the United States doesn't have universal health care to this day, unique or almost unique among industrialized nations, and that it has to do with the history of race in this country. So here's another example. Way back when, you write, the argument about dependence on government benefits came up. We hear that to this day. Of course, it was a big, you know, Paul Ryan thing when he wanted to cut benefits in the name of the budget. It was a big Newt Gingrich thing in the 90s when they had that big welfare reform. Do you have an origin story, kind of the dependence of recipients as a scare tactic?
I think that, again, goes right back to when they established the Freedmen's Bureau and the ambivalence that we were just speaking of. So there was enough push, I think, from the northern states and also from the newly emancipated themselves. So they became some of the first advocates for federal health care because they were being denied charity care. They were being denied, you know, just basic sustenance. And so former black soldiers who had been promised certain rations petitioned their leaders for medical care and for more food for their families. And that became some of the first advocacy towards this. And what else? Yeah, so I think that was kind of the beginning of all of that. In terms of the origin story, the pushback against that, again, happened in Congress where they said black people are idle by nature. They're lazy by nature. And it's actually, again, this biological difference that the best way to keep them healthy is to subject them to hard labor. And we former slaveholders know more about black bodies and about black health than anybody else. And this is what we're telling you. If you give them help, it's just going to breed dependence because that is the way they are biologically made.
And we did a segment last week, which was about all the ways when after it no longer became politically acceptable to say black people are idle by nature and things like that, that the rhetoric shifted to things like, well, we just don't want Americans to become dependent on benefits.
Yeah.
But sort of everybody knew who they were talking about.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things to me is, you know, I've reported a little bit on the Medicaid work requirements. And one of the arguments that comes up with that, people who support Medicaid work requirements will often argue that gainful employment is foundational to health. And that's not entirely wrong. If you have gainful employment, you're likely to be more healthy. But the relationship is actually goes the other way around. You need to be healthy in order to work. But that argument that working is the key to being healthy, it goes back again to the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau and the resistance against that.
And you're jumping way ahead of the historical narrative. But let's go there because it was another interesting thing in your piece. The backlash to Obamacare, I guess it was part of, where Arkansas established recently a work requirement forcing nearly 20,000 people off their insurance plans. And, of course, the work requirement for benefits, you know, are generally premised on what many consider a legitimate social contract was if you want the rest of the American people, the other taxpayers, to pay for your health care or pay for your food stamps or whatever it is, you owe them to work in exchange.
Exactly. And it wasn't just Arkansas. Arkansas was the one state that I think was able to implement them before it went through the courts and it was stopped. But there are several states that are actually still trying to do that. And some of those are in appeals right now. So it's kind of hanging in the balance whether we'll have work requirements or not.
And I guess the number in your article at that point indicates the implications of having work requirements. I guess we could go through all of these people and find out if they just, they didn't feel like working, so they gave up their health insurance, or if there were real obstacles to them working. But 20,000 people in one state losing their health insurance because of a work requirement means something's going on.
Yeah, and you know, there's enough research to kind of show and lay out that it's not that those 20,000 people all got jobs, and it's not even that all of those 20,000 people were ineligible because they weren't working. That all the research suggests, you know, and this has been done in the past, that when you implement these things, the most people that are kicked off the programs and that lose the benefit, the majority of them are actually working, but they're working in low-wage jobs where you don't have consistent hours. So maybe one month you meet the monthly requirement and the next month you fall short. Also, you know, if you don't have access to a computer or the internet, there's barriers to actually registering and logging these things.
Or
the bureaucracy.
Off the books, if we're talking about poor people, we're talking about a lot of underground economy.
Exactly. Cash labor, so those things, they don't count.
And how does that tie back to race, which is the point of the piece?
You know, I think that's a tough question to answer, and it's hard to speak to the specific motivations of the entities that are enacting these things now. And, you know, I leave it to the reader to make those conclusions. But I will say that, you know, the line back to where that began and where those arguments began is overtly white supremacist. So, I mean, you can debate, you know, what the causes and consequences are now, but you cannot debate that. That's a historical precedent.
You tell the story of the nation's first black female MD.
Yeah.
And you quote from her, who was Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler?
She was one of so many just different unsung heroes that I had never known about until I did this piece. And, you know, we're never taught some of these things in school, which is unfortunate. But Rebecca Lee Crumpler was born a free woman. She's a black woman. And she got her MD at a time when it was almost impossible for any woman, a white woman, to get a medical education, but she did. She was born and raised in Boston. She practiced there. And at the close of the Civil War, she decided to go to the South. She was the only black woman doctor, I think, at the time. And she was certainly the only black woman doctor to work for the Freedmen's Bureau. And she went and she set up shop in Virginia. And she worked in these communities of newly emancipated people, you know, who were struggling, as I said earlier, against so many different, you know, illnesses and shortcomings in care. And not only did she get an MD at a time when it was impossible for black women to do that, but she wrote a book called Medical Discourses, or I think it's called Medical Discourses. And it's just a discourse on the burdens of black diseases in black communities, or the burden of disease in black communities. And, you know, while congressmen are arguing, you know, white congressmen are arguing vehemently, and I think even the New York Times and probably some other media outlets are kind of accepting this argument of extinction and biological inferiority and, you know, even the depravity of the black race as being responsible for the illnesses that they're dealing with. She did a very scientific study. And as I quote her in the piece, she said, you know, they seem to forget, they remember this when it comes to white illness, but they seem to forget when it comes to black illness that there's actually a cause for every medical condition and that they may have the power to actually remove those causes and create health. And so it was just, to me, there was so many different ways that the newly emancipated and then, you know, marginalized black communities throughout history pushed back against this kind of discrimination and exclusion from our healthcare system. But to me, that was just such an eloquent rejoinder, because this was someone that, you know, by all accounts should never have risen to that level. And she did. And she spoke powerfully and with grace.
My guest is Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board and a contributor to the Times 1619 Project, observing that this is the 400th anniversary this year, and in fact today, of the first African people brought to the United States in slavery and some of the ramifications for our country ever since. And her article is about health care. Then you get to the New Deal. Social Security, yay. Collective bargaining, yay. But
8-hour workday.
Ways without saying race that black people were excluded.
Yeah. So the way this played out was, by the time you get to the New Deal era, the former slave states wielded enormous congressional power through a Southern voting bloc that was almost exclusively Democratic and overwhelmingly and pretty overtly segregationist. So these were white supremacists in Congress. And they were so powerful and such a united voting bloc that you essentially could not get legislation through without their consent. And the two things that they did, the way that they kind of secured the racial hierarchy that was prevailing in the South at that time, and that was a hierarchy that had delivered all of the region's power and resources to them at the to the exclusion of former slaves. They created a system by which if you wanted them to sign off on a legislation or to support that legislation, you had to grant them concessions. And the concessions they sought were, one, states' rights. So, yes, we will take all of these public progressive programs that provide aid to people in need, because the South was a relatively, you know, a very poor region for black and for white. But you have to let us determine how to allocate those funds. You have to let us determine how to distribute those funds. And guess who they distributed the funds to, and guess who got cut out of the deal? We're talking about people that were white supremacists in Congress. And so that's how that happened. And that's how that played out.
A piece of discrimination history that I did not know, should have known, I guess, but didn't know until I read your piece. The American Medical Association did not originally allow black doctors to join.
Yeah, so that was, I think it was basically through the local chapters. They allowed all the local chapters across the country to determine their own rules and regulations for who could be a part of the American Medical Association. But the consequence of that, again, was that black people were effectively barred and were not allowed.
So it was in some states and not in others.
I think it was in most states. I think it was actually in the majority of states. But if you want to get super technical about it, it wasn't necessarily the national organization.
Right.
It was actually the state organizations. But they've acknowledged that. So I don't think it's really in dispute. Mm-hmm. The national association has.
And you describe, therefore, how lay people, sort of lay medical people, I guess, when formal education was out of reach, formed their own networks and systems. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. There's like you could do a whole book on it, and in fact, several great ones have been written about this, and I've tweeted out the links to some of those. So in the wake of this exclusion, you know, Black communities were not merely victimized. You know, they pushed back in so many completely profound ways. So if you look at just the lay Black community, middle-class Black women created an entire, like, national public health movement, you know, just through lobbying, through charity, through just progressive work, and they created this thing they called Club Women. It was, you know, like women from the National Society. I can't remember the name of the society, but, you know, there were all these different societies of middle-class Black women who were pushing public health initiatives and going into the poorer communities and teaching them all of the things that they didn't have access to kind of create health, because they didn't have access to doctors. They couldn't get into white hospitals, you know, and they went so far as to, there was an entire movement, like a Black hospital movement, where the hospitals were segregated and it was separate and unequal, which means the white hospitals were much better than the Black hospitals. Instead of accepting that, the Black community, you know, did all kinds of things to raise money and to acquire resources to create medical schools and to improve the Black hospital. So if we have to be separate, maybe we can try to be equal. And they did that just through their own labors and their own efforts. And that was in the lay community. If you look at the Black medical community, the doctors that were acquiring MDs through, like, the two Black medical colleges that they had access to, they were the ones that ultimately pushed back against the American Medical Association. And so it was this kind of, for the AMA, an unintended consequence. You excluded this group of people, and now they have created their own power, and now they are pushing for national laws that will support their own.
We're almost out of time. I do want to mention the Affordable Care Act, which you bring up in the article. And I remember when we were doing the show during the debate for the Affordable Care Act, and then when it first got passed, there were some guests we had who really lauded it as one of the major civil rights or, you know, racial equality laws of our era. It wasn't sold like that explicitly, but it really was.
Yeah, it's kind of there's so many things I learned reporting this. This was not, and I've written a lot about Medicare and Medicaid, and I had no idea. But what basically happened was the National Medical Association, which was the leading association of Black doctors, you know, they led the charge pushing for not just Medicare. It had originally started as a push for a national health care system, specifically because Black communities were being excluded from the white medical system that had arisen. They didn't have access to, you know, employer-based health insurance as much as white people did. They were segregated from the hospitals. They didn't have as many doctors. There was just multiple ways that they were shut out of the system. And so for them, of course, they wanted universal health care because that's the only way to make it equal. The American Medical Association didn't want that because they wanted doctors to be in control of the health care system, and they didn't want the government taking over, another familiar argument. And so what happened was Medicare became a civil rights act. And it was actually through Medicare that hospitals were desegregated, because when you passed civil rights legislation that said you cannot segregate by race any institution that receives federal funding. Okay, that's like one part. And then the second part is you pass Medicare, which gives every senior citizen in the country federally funded health care. That means every hospital in the country is going to be flooded with federal dollars. And when that happens, guess what? You can't segregate these hospitals anymore.
So do you see the Medicare for All debate now through that lens?
I think it's hard not to once you, like, learn the history. And there's still so much, like, I think, learning that needs to be done. But, yeah, I mean, I think, again, the line is pretty clear and pretty direct.
Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board. Her article in the Times 1619 Project is called "Why Doesn't the United States Have Universal Health Care? The Answer Has Everything to Do with Race." Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Since you're my special friend, come closer for a special treat. I'm going to let you touch me in a special place.
It is never okay to touch someone else's private parts. Your mom and dad will tell you so.
Prince Andrew, Queen Elizabeth's son, has been forced to distance himself from the billionaire paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The British royal was a friend of the disgraced American financier who killed himself in jail earlier this month. A video has emerged showing Prince Andrew inside the billionaire's home in New York 2 years after Epstein was jailed for soliciting a teenage girl for prostitution. I heard more about how Prince Andrew has become embroiled in the scandal again from our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Well, you say drawn into it again. It's again and again is the real problem. And this was the latest sort of iteration of his appearances with Jeffrey Epstein, his relationship. And the palace, Buckingham Palace, clearly felt it needed to make some kind of statement as this video emerged of the prince in Jeffrey Epstein's house in Manhattan, New York, in 2010, after he'd been convicted, after Mr. Epstein had been convicted of child sexual offences. So the statement from the palace said the Duke of York has been appalled by the recent reports of Jeffrey Epstein's alleged crimes. His Royal Highness deplores the exploitation of any human being, and the suggestion that he would condone, participate in, or encourage any such behaviour is abhorrent.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a look at the video. You see, catch a glimpse of Prince Andrew waving as a woman leaves, and then he sort of glances around. How damaging is this for the prince and the royal family?
Well, we knew that Prince Andrew had maintained his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein after Mr. Epstein had been convicted of child sex offences in 2008. We know that they were seen walking in Central Park in Manhattan in 2010. We didn't know that Prince Andrew had either stayed or at least visited the house that Mr. Epstein had in Manhattan, a rather large townhouse in Manhattan. And it is a reminder that the royal family really didn't need of what is clearly a terrible lapse of judgment, what is acknowledged to be a lapse of judgment by Prince Andrew in maintaining a friendship with a convicted paedophile. And that's why we've had this statement, another attempt to draw a line. However, we either expect or we think there may be more information coming out about the relationship, more allegations about Prince Andrew as court papers are opened up and further allegations are made about Mr. Epstein's behaviour by those who allege that he sexually abused them.
Johnny Diamond, our royal correspondent.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 24, 2019. So I have been told. You're hanging out with a convicted child rapist. And they call that a lapse of judgment. Words are very important. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. One of the things that we are supposed to be paying attention to is use of words. If you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, questions, just information you would like to share, things that happened over the past 7 days or so, feel free to dial in the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. For the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share this week. First of all, the cows. 2019 10-year anniversary counter-racist yoga retreat for Florida, December 28th to January 1st. All of the information is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. I have shared it on social media repeatedly. I will post it again during this broadcast. But again, the dates, December 28th, that is a Saturday, to January 1, that is a Wednesday, during the so-called holidays, we will have plant-based meals. Chef Nadira will be flying in from Virginia, if the Coon Man allows. She'll be preparing vegan breakfasts, lunches, dinners. If you have thoughts about the menu, we have ample time to go through all of that. We'll have counter-racist workshops, at least one of them, will deal with how you navigate the holidays as an attempted counter-racist scientist. We'll also have food workshops. Chef Nadira will show how to prepare veggies in a tasty, delicious manner. Again, we'll be in Davenport, Florida. Everyone will have a bed. We have maximum space for 13 people, December 28 to January 1. If you're interested, drop an email if you need any details. The deadline for the deposit is September 15th. Looking forward to hanging out at the end of the year in a warm environment where we can do some yoga. There's a pool at the residence. Have fun. Be helpful. Discuss counter-racist ideas. Grand way to start what they call the new year. Again, email if you need information, untiljustice@gmail.com. And the material is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Moving forward, I think I shared yesterday, the book club, we finished up Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear, and he has a lot of suggestions. Well, he practices white supremacy racism, in my view, in the book. O.J. Simpson and Al Sharpton jabs aside, he does give out also some constructive suggestions around workplace violence and around what they call domestic violence. And I shared some of my neighbors had what they call a domestic dispute. Unfortunately, it was non-white people, and it got violent, physical violence. And I repeated Mr. Fuller repeatedly, first time, last time, and that should be said at the beginning of the so-called relationship when you're doing your questions and all of that. As the week proceeded, because this happened early in the week, so as we got towards the end of the week, I got details, and what did I find out? So before things got to this physical altercation between a male and a female, non-white victims of racism, before it got to that point, a few drinks. What does that moron say at the end of each podcast? What is it? It's sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Now, I often say that the worst combination in the known universe, whites, alcohol. I've been saying that for a decade. However, a lot of the times when I give the public service announcement about let's stay sober, I also include, hey, being around victims of racism who are under the influence, a lot of times that can end up being a real destructive scenario as well. Sobriety would be best. First time, last time. Next, get my list here. Dr. Ball thought of Pam and Dr. Welsing. Both of them have major ties to Chicago, importance of black mental health practitioners, and his work to discussing racism, white supremacy. I saw some of the different reports. I'm ashamed to say I hadn't really heard of Dr. Carl Bell until he passed, and Michelle Martin, black journalist, was talking about him on NPR, but I'm going to post just so people can see more of the work that he did. He was talking directly about the problem, white supremacy, racism, and even some of the anti-black violence that happens as a result of white supremacy, but did a lot of constructive work in Chicago. Next, I thought it was important with all of the talk about the law change in California and Eric Garner in New York, I thought it was important with the New York situation that they made a distinction between saying that this chokehold is banned, but it's not illegal. And making a distinction between those two terms, a legal distinction, and what it would mean if this chokehold becomes illegal as opposed to just being banned. I thought that was important. With California, this is the second time Governor Newsom, suspected race soldier, he just signed that Crown Act that's supposed to stop
a mistreatment of black people in the workplace because of having natural hair. That was just within the past few weeks. And now they come out and he signs this legislation like, this Governor Newsom fellow is going to look like, you know, wow, he is really serious. I am sincerely and greatly pained about racism and doing all I can with my governor's pen here in the great state of California to pass counter-racist legislation. Like, he will be able to make a pretty significant appeal to a lot of victims of racism, I think. Might even be someone, I'm surprised they aren't saying that he should be someone thinking about running for president in the future, if not 2020, 2024. One to ponder. Continuing. The Eric Garner situation in New York, where the suspected race soldier who killed Mr. Garner 5 years after the death, the murder, he's now been terminated from the New York Police Department. I think the commissioner, Pat King, another suspected race soldier, when all of this originally happened in 2014, I think he and some of the other enforcement officials and whites in general who were upset about the flack the enforcement office, police department was receiving about Mr. Garner's murder. And it's, well, we just won't work as hard. They had a number of reports talking about what they called a slowdown, where enforcement officials weren't giving out tickets, allegedly, or weren't stopping people, weren't enforcing infractions, and were costing New York City money. They weren't getting all of those fines and what have you. And it sounded like they were talking about something similar this time around. Also, I thought immediately Mr. Fuller again, producejustice.com, when he says, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. Now, Mr. Pantaleo has been terminated. They already said he's filing an appeal suit. I have seen that before, where an enforcement official, sometimes where they even killed a black person, and they get fired, and they file an appeal, and sometimes you might have to wait a year, you wait 2 years, and then, boop, get their job back. And not sometimes it won't even just be that they get their job back. They'll get their job back, and they'll get all of the back pay that they lost for being so-called terminated for a year or what have you. And sometimes, even if it's not that, they just move, you know, a county over, and they submit a new application and get a new badge and a new firearm and a new nigger stick. Next, nigger knocker. How can I mess that up? It's Norm Stamper. 2009, nigger knocker. It's not nigger knocker, nigger knocker. Let's see. Hannah Nicole Jones, the segment on 1619 and looking at so-called 400 years of slavery. White supremacy racism is slavery. Hannah Nicole Jones has a white parent. The cowbell was there for a reason. She has done a lot of work on white supremacy racism, especially focused on schools. If you read the New York Times or even ProPublica, she has a lot of reports going back for years talking about what they call segregation in schools and how you're increasingly seeing more and more, particularly poor black children heavily concentrated in schools where it will just be lots and lots of poor black children. And these schools tend to do very poorly, have very poor resources. They do not get the highest ranked educators, teachers to come and be a part of their program. They end up having a very tough time, and it seems to be by design. But that's what she does a lot of reporting on. That would be another illustration. And in fact, I paused because I have played reports and read reports, shared information from Hannah Nicole Jones before. I don't think I had stopped to investigate. Said, wait a minute, does she have a white parent? Or just to confirm. And I did this time around. And I said, wow, Michelle Alexander, Melissa Harris Perry, Hannah Nicole Jones, all have a white parent. Barry and her, they're all prominently featured for talking about racism, white supremacy. If you want to toss President Barack Obama in there as well, that would be fine. He also has a white parent. But I just thought that that was interesting, especially Melissa Harris Perry, Hannah Nicole Jones. Just, I don't know, something struck me as similar. They seem to be white people seem to be all right. If you want to talk about racism and use the paradigm that any of those three females present, non-white females, Melissa Harris Perry, Michelle Alexander, Nicole Hannah-Jones, that is acceptable. You can go and write your thesis, or you can turn in, if you have a high school paper and you want to talk about racism, you could probably quote one of those three and be all right. That's legitimate. I don't know about Neely Fuller, certainly not Gus T, but you could do one of those three. Cowbell. Interestingly, in the segment where they were talking about slavery and 400 years, I thought there was a lot of great information in the report. It reminded me of The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptist. We read that on the book club way back 2015 and right into 2016 with a lot of great information. But it also, I paid attention to the way that she discussed the segment, and I'm alert. If I know that a person, if you're married to a white person, you have a white parent, I'm alert to how they, the words that they use to describe the problem. And particularly when she got to the end and they discussed how, I think the way it was phrased was, black people have perfected our democracy here in this part of the world, whatever that means. That's one of those words Mr. Fuller cautions about, democracy. What do people mean when we say that? You can't have a system of democracy and a system of white supremacy, racism, global system. But she said that black people, in addition to participating in every war that this country has fought, but we also have waged 250 years of war against our own country. And I played that back because I said, whoa, paying attention to words again, I am not at war with anybody. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Coretta Scott King, I don't think they were at war with anybody. Minister Malcolm X, he was not at war with anybody. Rosa Parks was not at war with anyone. Dr. Cambon, matter of fact, give credit, KamalCambon.org pointed that out years ago. Be accurate with words. Dr. Cambon is not at war with anybody. Racist man, racist woman, racist child are at war with us. And Hannah Nicole Jones' report for the New York Times, that is evidence of the war, which is ongoing. Eric Garner's death, that's further evidence of the war. You have, and all the people that I listed, Dr. King, Coretta Scott King, et al., they are victims of that war and are responding to it. That's why Mr. Fuller uses concepts like counter-war, counter-violence. They have counter-terrorism program. Freedom fighters, counter-terrorists, whichever you like. That's what it is. That's so important, particularly in this climate, to say that we are at war, black people are at war with their own country. That's how you end up. People coming out and say, we got black identity extremists. They're at war with America. No, we're in a system of white supremacy racism. I am a victim of the war of white terrorism that is being waged worldwide. Words are very important. And they, even in the segment that followed where they gave all of that information about, we don't have health care in this part of the world. Why? System of white supremacy. We don't want the Negroes to be too healthy. Can't have a plantation run correctly if you have robust and healthy Negroes. Now, we want them to be healthy enough to get out there and pick that cotton, but not healthy enough that they start asking questions, using their brain computer correctly to figure out what is happening here and what should be done to solve this problem. That right there is why we are having the COWS 2019 10-year anniversary yoga retreat. It was said at the Virginia edition that is the protest, taking care of yourself every day, not eating Cheetos, not getting the new Popeye's chicken sandwich, but taking great care of ourselves, eating well, getting our exercise, getting our rest so that we can function well and be the exact threat that they talked about in that news segment. That is exactly why we are having the yoga retreat. Anyway, even from that segment about healthcare, I thought it was so important. They had said that, and they said it explicitly, that they said racism hurts white people. And the way that I tend to view it, or I think is more accurate, White people are very willing to harm, mistreat other white people, particularly if it strengthens the system of white supremacy. Those are just white sacrifices. You have some of that when you are waging war, which is what white people are doing. You already know you're going to have some losses. You just try to minimize those on your side. Moving down the list, let's see. I'll get to some of my other topics later. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. We are also on Cash App. You can visit cash.app/$TheCows. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have supported The Cows for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into all the newfangled apps and such, you can drop an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Again, tremendous thanks to all the folks who have supported. I hope The Cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also nab items from the wish list at Amazon.com. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade. Thanks for all of the things that have been picked up from the list. They have helped to keep us on the air, hopefully providing accurate, constructive information about what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what we can do to solve this problem immediately. Specifically, exclusively on this program, the compensatory call-in, I do request if we could not use metaphors. I have concluded that one of the ways that white people practice white supremacy, racism, and deception specifically, they will skillfully employ metaphors, analogies, similes, often to suggest or sometimes to explicitly state that you have two separate concepts and they are absolutely identical, exact same thing. And frequently that is not the case at all. That is just the behavior of a master deceiver. Victims of white supremacy, including myself, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries at this point. And many of us, we are still learning. We have not exactly come to conclusions on all matters. And so sometimes we just don't have the logic to articulate our views. We will substitute with an analogy of some sort, and often that just adds a lot more confusion. If we could be direct, specific about what it is that we would like to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. If folks could take about 5 minutes with your comments, questions, suggestions, that would be great. Make sure that everybody has at least one opportunity to share. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you are salivating over the return of NCAA football or anything else, you're at a summer, end of summer barbecue or whatever else is happening, just use your mute button. That way we don't have a lot of unnecessary background noise. You can say what you need to share and then just mute. And then if you need to speak again, you can unmute your line. Right on. With that, I will two last things, and then I'll begin nabbing our callers. One, I did see, I guess predictably, not that I was surprised, there was name calling. People were displeased with Mr. Jay-Z about his partnership with the NFL. I think we had talked about that before. I know Thomas in New York, some other folks. And I will BGQ to Mr. Jay-Z. If anyone is to blame about that situation, it would be racist man, racist woman. I certainly would not fuss at Mr. Jay-Z or anyone else if they came and said, hey, let's do a partnership. We will compensate you and you can, you know, I guess come make a commercial or sing a song or whatever it's going to be to help us promote our brain damage event, call it football. You know, hey, whatever. You're an entertainer. That's what you do. But I certainly would not be upset with Jay-Z. He is a victim of white supremacy. Racists are amazing, absolutely amazing at getting victims of white supremacy to focus our frustrations on other victims of racism. I said President Obama's name, I thought. Anyway, the last thing, I mentioned this yesterday on workplace racism, but mentioning it again, just in case we have different listeners who might have a thought or suggestion. We had a black mother who is doing a spectacular job and breastfeeding. She said that the current plantation where she is employed, they do have a lactation room. They allowed her to use the room for the first year. That's in accordance with the law. After that first year, she says she wants to continue at least through 2 years, which is outstanding attempted counter-racist parenting. Food, nourishment is super important. And so they said, well, wait a minute now. We let you use the lactation room for a year, and we were upset about that. But now, you know, you're hogging the room. We're not going to let you use it anymore. They took away, I guess it was a code key or something on the lactation room. They changed the code so she doesn't have the key anymore. When she went to ask about this, said, oh, no, time's up. We got, you know, two other ladies that are using the room. Time's up. You used your year. And, you know, if you need space to do all that, just go out to your car. Triple T's, right? And even pause right there. If you could imagine a white woman on a job in almost 2020 being told, oh, no, we do have a lactation room, but it's not for you. Your time is up, buddy. You need to do all that. Go out in the car. Pull down your sun visor if you need a little privacy. Anyway, if we have listeners who have suggestions, questions you might ask, to restore access to the lactation room, how you would deal with that situation so as to not cause further problems, please share. That's why I said I feel really bad, remiss in not addressing how would our counter-racist code be adjusted for being pregnant, attempted parent in the workplace. Very important. But if folks have thoughts on that, you can share the number again, 605-313-5133. 64, decode 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, thoughts on what happened, I'm sure folks heard lots of tackiness with the slavery celebrations or whatever they want to call. Oh, that is one more. Can I get two for Dr. Cambon? I said I was going to get to the callers. I'll get two. It was well earned this week. Dr. Cambon said, we are not at war, because that's very common where black people will say that, you know, we are at war. We've been waging war. They'll say exactly what Hannah Nicole Jones said. We've been waging war against it. And they say, that is not true. That is not true. Black people, you can look at our behavior clearly. We are not at war with anyone. Racist man, racist woman, they are at war with us. Secondly, Dr. Cambod, I believe, and I looked for the audio. He was on the cows. He's been a guest many times, Dr. Cambon. I believe we're talking about the assassination of Minister Malcolm X. And I said our cows anniversary is on February 21st. That is the same date that Minister Malcolm was assassinated. That is not a coincidence. And I referenced it as an anniversary, and Dr. Cambon, he said, that is not the correct word. That would not be an anniversary. An anniversary generally would be some sort of celebration of an amount of time that has passed and, you know, in a joyous manner, recognizing that event and, you know, how much time has transpired. With an assassination or a killing, that is not a celebration. Certainly, that would be more just recognizing it has been this amount of time since this took place. It was on, I'm very certain, that was on a broadcast, and it was in reference to Minister Malcolm X's assassination. But they referenced all this week the 400-year anniversary of slavery. That is for sure not an anniversary. Words are very important. This is not a celebration. It would just be recognizing 400 years and moving from there. But as I said, I'm sure folks heard lots of tacky and trifling commentary all week long. If you have comments, questions to share, *61. First few folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Pelosi.
Can Hello, I be heard?
I heard both of you. We'll get B in Toronto first.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you also to the callers and listeners. So, in terms of the Eric Gardner case and the fact that the so-called justice or just us system, just us being for white people, held on to evidence for 5 years, knowing that the police that were involved in Eric Gardner's murder, it just makes me wonder, where is the checks and balances for the justice system? The fact that an illegal chokehold was used, causing Eric Gardner to be murdered, and then police officers lied about it by manipulating their reports to make it seem as if it's all Mr. Gardner's fault. The Gardner family has gone through so much. Erica Gardner had a heart attack after having her child. I believe the grandfather was walking down the aisle, one of the children for marriage in Jamaica, and he had a heart attack and died. This family has gone through so much, as with many other Black families under the system of white supremacy or care units, because, well, we're not allowed to have families here. So the fact that the police can obstruct justice, they can commit perjury, they can murder, and, oh, yes, they can wait 5 years to be fired after the murder with no jail time. It's very Gestapo-esque, I'd have to say. It's very much like a concentration camp. In addition to the observation of 400 years of slavery, unless whites are going to be divesting themselves of their whiteness and actually, you know, doing something to stop racism, I fear that the observation is going to continue beyond 400 years. On our part, I believe that we need to also do something about it, which is exactly what you've mentioned, Gus, about counter-racist techniques. And it needs to be done now if some people have not implemented that strategy. Thank you. I leave the line.
Much obliged, B in Toronto, global system of racism, white supremacy. Just slight correction. The chokehold, again, is not illegal. It is banned. Not the same thing. Banned chokehold, the Eric Gardner law that they are hoping to pass, that would make the chokehold illegal. But presently, it is banned, not illegal. Much obliged for your patience, M. Hondisi. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, sir. So that chokehold, I see it often in MMA fights, and it doesn't matter how strong or fit you are. When that chokehold is put, when that chokehold is applied to an individual, it will kill them. That's why you have to tap the person, you know, to let them know, hey, I'm about to die. I wanted to I want to make sure that I'm, how do I say? I have to understand that black people are not at war with white people. White people are at war with black people. I have that understanding. I don't have the full understanding of the interaction of black people and black people. And then even when we're talking about different groups of black people with different groups of black people, I'm not understanding that interaction, whether that should be described as war or that should not be described as war. I know that it's caused by white people, ICE albinos. While I was in Ghana, I was at the Year of Return celebration where they told me, or they announced at the celebration, supposed celebration, that the reason for it was because 400 years ago, Ghanaians were taken from Ghana and brought over to America in 1619. But I don't celebrate anything, so I don't call it a celebration. I don't even celebrate my birthday. That's how I was raised, so I don't celebrate anything. But at that particular event, Black Americans were used to advertise, Black Americans' names were used to advertise the event, and then all the benefits were given to Ghanaians who left 50 years ago. You know, so my concern with that is, well, how are we going to have an alliance? You know, I'll move on. The other thing I wanted to mention is ICE albinos, white people, state in a number of articles, I read a number of years ago, that in an article that white people murdered enough black people in America to cool the entire globe down, to cool the entire planet. They killed enough black people to cool the entire planet. And according to the article, they killed over 90% of the people in America. I also looked to see, you know, where that article was, and now there's new articles saying the exact same thing, and it's posted in it's several news outlets saying the same thing. Bill Gates said at the, I think it was the Bilderberg meeting, that they had to get the number of people, it was referring to black people, they had to get the number of black people, they had to murder enough black people to where the black population was near zero in order to cool the planet down. So that's upsetting. Another thing is, I mentioned that 1,000 black people could move to Antarctica, the Arctic. 1,000 black people could go to the Arctic and melt the ice there. But perhaps it would be 300 times that number, perhaps 4,000 times that number that would have to go to that area. However, I might be completely incorrect, but I do think that if we had vast numbers of black people in the Arctic, it would thaw the ice. We would figure it out. It would thaw the ice, and that would raise the heat index of the entire planet to where white people would not be able to live in America and in Africa and in Australia and in many other parts of the world. They would have to move to the parts of the world that are cold enough for them. However, just by the mention of that, or just white people are now militarizing Greenland as they were doing before, but even more so militarizing Greenland, which is full of ice. There's articles that say that ICE albinos plan to cover the land ice with enough plastic to cover all the ice on that land in order to not allow that ice to melt. The ice is their priority. is one of their priorities. And the chemtrails that they spray every day is to block out the sun. And they're going to do it more often because it's cooling down towards the end of the summer. So it's going to be a whole lot until the summer starts again and it gets too hot to do it. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Yes, sir, Mr. Steele. I did just want to respond to the question really quick that was presented. I think Imhan DC, he was saying that he understands that white people are waging war against black people, not the other way around. Very important. I often think that many of us, we understand that. Like, even if we don't say it, we understand that, but it just doesn't get articulated that way frequently. But words are important. Anyway, with the next component, he was saying in terms of what is it called in terms of the black people, non-white people, mistreating other non-white people. And the specific example where he was talking about, I guess there was some sort of an event. I think he said that they used black people that were born in the States or used their name or of some sort to promote the event. But then the proceeds from the event went to individuals who were born in Ghana and maybe live there now. And he was saying, you know, how do we call this an alliance? And I think that's why Mr. Fuller talks about united, independent to grasp that we're not at war with white people. And we're not unified. There is no alliance. Just because we are, quote unquote, black people, just because we're non-white people, that doesn't exist. That's why it's encouraged, united, independent. And a lot of what his suggestions, I think almost all of them are tailored to an individual to go about solving your problems as an individual and not thinking that this is some, you know, group, this is some collective of black people. I mean, just you see the evidence daily in terms of victims of white supremacy having a difficult time, even in the same family, being able to get along without a lot of conflict and do things that are constructed. Attempted families. That's what it was just said. That's Dr. Wells. That's what she said. These are people who share DNA, much less talking about people who, you know, you were born on the other side of the planet and we are supposed to get along and be unified just on the basis of being victims of terrorism. That is going to be very, very challenging. Details and united, independent. I think that's why that is suggested. United, independent, and grasping that, and just grasping that racists have set this up deliberately so that there's not a lot of cooperation amongst victims of racism. That's, you know, how you maintain a plantation. Hope that was logical, Mr. Steele. Thank you for your patience. Proceed, sir.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele, and I'm in, I guess I'm in Hollywood at the moment, and I am riding through a residential area, and there seems to be a whole bunch of dudes walking around with small hats, big hats, very characteristic hats. A lot of gentlemen walking around with characteristic hats, and you know, I was just taking a look around, and I passed a facility where a lot of these people worship. And there were guys standing in front of that facility that looked like tough customers. That they looked like very tough people. And they looked very capable of handling themselves in a fight. Sorry about that metaphor there. And I was watching these people walk around. And you know, I thought to myself, I was listening to the report on Eric Garner. I thought to myself, could you snatch one of those guys and start choking him in the middle of the street and expect everybody to just watch that happen? And, you know, I couldn't imagine it. I couldn't imagine it. But be it the ones with the Stetson-type hats, be it the ones with the really small hats, be it the ones with the big beaver pelt-looking hats, I don't think you could walk up to them, start harassing them in the middle of the street, then choke them out. I just don't think that would go in a way where people would stand around and do nothing. I think that the statement that, you know, black people are at war I think it's a very great distinction that has been made tonight, that we are not at war. I do not see ourselves comporting ourselves like other people who do make it very clear that they are at war and they're actively conducting warfare. And I just see that that the way that we comport ourselves is very different from that. Recently, I'm going to switch topics real quick. And I just want to say recently I was looking for an apartment here in the area. And I'm actually moving out of Los Angeles, and I'm moving to a place called Van Nuys, which isn't that far, but it's a different city. And the whole time I'm looking for a place, one of the reasons why I'm looking for a new place is I'm getting a roommate who's a victim of racism himself. And this is just an attempt to, you know, cut down on expenses. I just, I think I mentioned on a previous broadcast that I spent a lot of money renting in Los Angeles last year, and I just wanted to save on my expenses. So the thing that was hanging up getting an apartment was that there were issues with my credit report and my roommate's credit report. Now, my roommate's credit report, I was unable to figure out everything because I was able to fix my report to the point where it was sufficient enough to get housing in this area. I just want to stress how important it is to keep track of. Oh, man, I'm holding up the traffic because of Popeyes. Popeyes is holding up traffic. You can hear that. Yep. Anyway, so what is that? You have to keep real close attention to what's on those reports, because there was information on my report that was out of date and inaccurate, and it was literally preventing me from finding a place to live. I was in a really precarious situation where I could have been homeless. So I was able to, after a lot of research, I mean, it took a lot of research for me to find out exactly who was reporting this error and you know, how to get it removed. And I think a lot more of us need to pay attention to all of these agencies that hold all this information, download apps like the Experian app or like Credit Karma that allow you to take a look at what these agencies have on you, and don't be afraid to call them up directly and to challenge some of the information that's on there. It took me about a day and a half to find out all of the people that I needed to contact to get this changed, but I was able to, and I was able to get housing. Another thing that came up on this search that was very, very peculiar to me is that a lot of the property managers and a lot of the real estate agents are classified as what they would call LGBT. And I was being pressured by a few real estate agents that I was working with. I would say that they were Eastern European. They were saying things to me like, you know, do you and your roommate, do you have family photos? And I was just like, what do you mean family photos? You two together, you know, we want to have a picture of you two together to paint a picture. I was just like, whoa. So they were trying to construct a scenario similar to the one that was illustrated in, I believe there was a movie called Chuck and Larry, whereby they were taking two heterosexual males who wanted to get some sort of benefit or some sort of, something to their advantage. But in order to get this benefit, they had to pretend to be LGBT themselves. Look, this is something that's going on in this area. I think it's wrong. I don't know how to classify this level of discrimination. But the fact that if you're outwardly and declare yourself to be LGBT, it would make up for some sort of indiscrepancies with regard to your credit score with regard to your criteria for renting, the fact that that impacts it to the point where real estate agents, the people who are setting the market, are telling you to, you know, engage in this behavior, that's really happening. I think it's wrong, and I think it's something that needs to that needs to be classified, and it needs to be paid attention to, because it's crazy. I'm sorry. Sorry, I don't know what word to describe it, but it's very disturbing. And I'll go ahead and mute my line at this point.
Mm-hmm. Much obliged for sharing, Mr. Steele. That is, wow. If we have other people who have that, experience with renting, although I will say it does remind me of the report, or it reminds me of two things. The report that came out, I believe it was 2014, same summer that Eric Garner was strangled to death. But 2014, that report came out, I believe it was Princeton, my memory is all right, that if you are classified as gay, LGBTQ, you do not meet the normal standards where they show income, where if you're a black male, you make less than a white male, that disparity, as they call it, income disparity, it disappears. If you are a black and you are declared, it's known that you are a gay black male. That's one. And then the next thing that came to mind, listen in, Allison Manswell. She's a black female. She was a guest on the program back in 2016. She talked about how she almost felt like she was having to tell her black clients to emasculate themselves in order to have a job and to be subjected to less. And it almost fits that same pattern. If if they think you are LGBTQ, well, then, hey, we might be a little bit more lenient to having you be here as opposed to you just being two niggers in need of an apartment. And it's, hey, hit the road. Credit report is looking a little raggedy and your fingernails aren't too sharp and, niggers, beat it. But I mean, if other folks have had that experience or have thoughts on that, please share. I do think words are important. It would be important. That, in my view, might just be not crazy, but the system of racism, white supremacy. I know Dr. Welsing certainly would have something to say about black males being more acceptable if they are presenting as LGBTQ or even just thought of, even if they're not, doing anything to present or to have people think this way. People are coming to that conclusion on their own. She certainly would have something to say about that. I suspect Mr. Fuller would as well, contempt for gender and all the sexual confusion. I think he's even on this broadcast talked about how racists are more comfortable having a black person who is participating in some anti-sex, maybe got some sexual confusion going on, they are more comfortable, more accepting of having that sort of person around, employed with a residence. We've heard that before. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Briefly, the credit report, much obliged for the suggestions there as well. I think Red in Nevada wrote in suggestions on a workplace racism broadcast just a few weeks back, and she said the same thing. Check out your credit report. And she, even one of the suggestions that she gave was to call, because sometimes if it's something that's old, or if you have a situation like that where you're trying to purchase a house, getting an apartment, or make some sort of major purchase involving your credit, you can sometimes request a one-time amnesty where you can get something removed that would boost your score, so that would make you a more appealing client for whatever it is that you're trying to do. Obviously, it's just little things that you asking questions, say that so frequently, just small things. And some of that you would have to have that report to be able to look at it, see what's there, to be able to do that. But that was a few recommendations she gave on workplace racism a few weeks back. Very important, sharing suggestions. Let's see. Other folks dialed in, if you have comments, questions, suggestions to share, line should be open. Proceed. Again, if we have any suggestions on being banned or barred from the lactation room, that would be super appreciated. If we have any parents who've dealt with that, if you have any tips, questions, strategies to help be able to get access returned to the lactation room in the workplace, please share. Don't be a spectator if you have successfully navigated that one. Let's see. While folks are spectating, getting their thoughts together.
Can I be heard about the breast room, the lactation room? Sorry.
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Yeah. In those situations, you want to have documented requests made by you in writing, preferably by email, that you have access to this room for this reason. And you want to sustain these requests, and you want to CC all of the major major HR people and all of the female C-level people within the organization. By doing that, you can, because the racial angle is not going to work in this regard. The best angle that you, or the racist angle, or the counter-racist angle is not going to work in that regard. I think that is a situation where you can make a sufficient case that there is some gender discrimination going on against a female employee, and HR departments and C-level executives who are female are not going to look too kindly on that. So if you can make repeated requests and sustained requests, and then you can track these requests, and if they still don't oblige after maybe the second or third request, it might be time to contact an employment lawyer. I know so many of us are nervous about contacting these people, but you should contact them, especially while you're still employed. When you contact them and you're still employed and they bring up the suit while you're currently an employee, that is a favorable position to be in, because they cannot fire you without risking a very easy retaliation suit. Because anytime that, you know, you can trace that they fired you in relation to remedying a situation with through human resources, especially if they fire you in response to that, that is illegal in right to work states. That's called retaliation. So if you want to establish a retaliation case or in lieu of getting access to this room, then I suggest you pursue that course of action. Request formally in writing, CC influential people in HR and in the C-suite, and then if they fail to acquiesce at that point, then feel free to contact a local employment attorney with your documentation, and I'm sure that a decent settlement will be you'll be looking at a decent settlement and protection while you're on the job.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I know in this case, HR has not been responsive thus far after request, so it would at least be beyond that point. They are sticking to the, you got your 1 year, get out in your vehicle if you got to do all that. Incidentally, the number one, we had a guest on the program earlier this year. We were talking about reading. This is a victim of racism. We were talking about reading, and their view was that black people don't read because we're lazy. We talked about that as BGQ, but I said I'm suspicious any time that I hear that there's a problem, there's some sort of critique of black people, and the conclusion is that this is because black people are lazy. I'm suspicious regardless of who it's from, because that is so consistent within the system of white supremacy. And then right in all of that, about 400 years slavery, the anniversary, as they said, that's right there. You don't have health care. Black people are lazy. They'll be sickly and die if we don't get them out there and working. We got to get sharecropping going on. We got to get them out in the field because they're just lazy. The nigger is just as lazy as can be. If you don't lash them, they'll just curl up and sit on the sofa all day long. That's what I mean. It is so ubiquitous in the system of white supremacy, and it's any era. It doesn't matter. 2020, 1920, 1820, there's always a reason to label black people as lazy. I'm extraordinarily resistant to that anytime it comes up in argument, suggestion, discussion at all. The other one, we do have a book club here at the Cows. I just said we finished Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear yesterday. New book, Tar Baby. We did get a few other suggestions, but this was suggested when we finished The Bluest Eye way, way back in 2012. And with Toni Morrison just passing, I thought it would be apropos. The book is all about racism, white supremacy, and it's on people's favorite area of people activity, Area 8. So I thought it would be the best of all worlds. Toni Morrison, Tar Baby, should be coming Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Reading is more important than watching television. Context of white supremacy. Star 6-1, other folks have comments. If folks are just spectating, if they are just overjoyed, they have college football back and all the goodies that go along with the conclusion of summer, well then, the spectating, once again, cannot replace white supremacy with justice if we're just going to sit back and spectate. We do need to be a tad more active about solving the problem. Other folks, if we missed you totally and you have a hand up, line should
May
be
I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and participants. First off, just jump into the Eric Garner case. I am based here in New York City. And one of the things that the media has pretty much blocked out and hasn't indicated, which is definitely Dr. Tommy Curry moment, the man not moment, which is Eric Garner was actually anally searched in the park, and he sued the NYPD over the anal cavity search where they quote-unquote handled his private parts in public. This wasn't a situation where they were in the police precinct or anything. They did it out in a public park. And henceforth, the reasoning when, sorry for anybody else who's seen the video, is pretty tragic, but that's part of the reasoning, obviously, for him being very, very upset and angry with them even trying to approach him and search him on the streets, because prior to that, they had done that search on him and he wasn't going to allow it again. That's something that has been left out of the conversation in the dialogue, I think, since the case has been open. I haven't even heard anybody mention it on any coast, but here, at least here, I guess, being in NYC, when we look through it, we find other people who brought the article up, and there's even actually a lawsuit. You could actually see the paperwork and his own writing in the Southern District of New York filing the claim and suing the NYPD over the situation, which I think is very, very – it's an extremely important part of the actual situation that's left out in all discussions that I've heard so far. The other thing was the medical aspect. I missed the beginning of the NPR part that you played, where I didn't get the lady's name, but in speaking about medical apartheid, pretty much, and it's just it's really interesting because the whole entire time I never thought about the aspect of part of the reason why we're never going to get affordable health care is that they don't want non-white people to have affordable health care. It's just that simple. And I've been dodging it, not thinking about it in that context. But now that I do, I have to really look at that. Also, I wanted to ask, is there a way that there was a specific medical doctor, she mentioned that published papers and documents that she found. And I wanted to actually know if you could reiterate that name so I could kind of get that, because I'm kind of curious as to what exactly was written. It sounded like that article itself could be extremely helpful and something to really get into. That being said, I will mute my line. Thank you for your time and energy. Peace.
Much obliged. The New York Times, that segment was widely circulated. It's the New York Times. So if you look online, their 1619 slavery piece, it's pretty massive. Nicole Hannah-Jones, and they have a lot of different authors. Like that was, I just played one segment, but it was a lot of different segments that touched on a lot of different things. So you can, I'll share the links, but you can pull up the specific report to her, and I'll see if I can struggle through a pronunciation, because she does have kind of an odd name, but I'll see if I can struggle through it once I pull up the specific report about slavery and healthcare, and I'll share it so people can read the report. And then it has everything that she mentioned in the interview is mentioned in the article, including the book and the references and all of that. You can check it out at your leisure. But they said they're even supposed to be giving out those copies. That was in a different segment that they went to areas where people don't have the Times, that don't subscribe, and they gave out copies for free. So it should be very, very easy for people to get access to those reports.
That's interesting, because I'm here in a predominantly non-white neighborhood in Bed-Stuy, and at a very, like, the remote center, pretty much. And when we get off the train, we don't get anything like that. We may get Final Call, and we may get Christian papers, but New York Times being handed out in the middle of a non-white neighborhood, predominantly black, is just not happening. So I'm curious to see where they're actually handing out this paperwork. But I am on the website right now, New York Times 1619 Project, and I see the audio series. So I'm definitely going to click on that and review this a little later on. Greatly appreciated. There was another – I just wanted to say one more thing. There was an African student that you had on the program some time back. I have recently looked at listened to the podcast. It was a real excellent podcast, and it's just so interesting to hear somebody from the continent and speaking in regards to what's actually going on, to give us some kind of relay as to what they're going through as opposed to what we are going through. And I'll find out exactly the name, and I'll send it to you in email. But I was curious to see if she'd be interested in giving us an update sometime again and being on the show again, because I'm sure in the midst of things that are going on right now that things have changed quite a bit or are still the same or increased to some degree. But I'll forward that information over to you via email. Thank you.
For sure. Janine Innerlandy is, I believe, the pronunciation. I could have messed that up. I said it was a little bit challenging, but you can go online, as I said, and read the report, Why Doesn't America Have Universal Health Care? And Jeanine, J-E-N-E-E-N, her last name, I-N-T-E-R-L-A-N-D-I, Interlandi, I think is it. And you can read, that's one, like this is a series, so that's one component, and then you can check out the whole 1619 Project. If you are interested. Other folks dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, line should be open. Folks that we missed totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. This week, myself and another non-white black male who is less confused than other non-white black people on the system of racist white supremacy plan to visit a meeting that was being orchestrated by an organization prior to it being mentioned to me. I have never heard of them, called Color of Change, just for a fact-finding field trip, you might say. There was a third party who both of us knew that had already been connected with the organization for, I think he said, about 3 or 4 years. Anyway, we both arrived pretty late. They called this particular meeting a mixer. And it reminded me, that term reminded me of being in college and of people, quote unquote, mixing, socializing, being sociable. And that's exactly what it was. I never did go inside, and the other non-white black male, we never did go inside. We were very late. Matter of fact, as I was viewing the activities through a window, large window, where they were having a meeting, I could see where they were wrapping up the ending the meeting. And so anyway, we decided to just ask the other person that we knew who was affiliated with this organization for 4 years questions about it. You know, questions and answers. That's the means to be able to find out about things. And so we proceeded, and it didn't seem that he knew a whole lot about the organization for someone who was around it for 4 years to the questions that were being asked. Anyway, that was an activity that was done this week. I mentioned on the workplace racism about the comment that I made on a firefighter's website based on a series of pictures that was taken about the latest recruit class coming out into the field, getting their civil badges and whatnot, that sort of thing. And I decided to question the idea of Dade County Fire Department. Are they living up to the standards that they're supposed to as far as hiring black people? And this website, which is operated by two black females, they took my comment right off the website. As though, I guess, as though, I don't know. I'm not going to even try to estimate on what the reasoning for that was. But nevertheless, it was done. There was something else. Forgot about it. When I remember it, I'll chime back in. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. The situation with the black females, workplace racism, neutralizing workplace racism each Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The situation with the black females being the ones, I guess, who operate the site, and maybe they're the ones who took down your question, are they living up to their hiring standards? That, again, to what was mentioned before about the alliance, black people being in an alliance or non-white people being unified, that is the system of white supremacy. And I don't know where these females, non-white females, I don't know what part of the world that they were born in, but I suspect they may have been born someplace closer to Florida than Ghana. I could be wrong, but that'll be my guess for the time being. And we still have problems. Whites are able to easily set up situations directly, indirectly, where we are in conflict and, you know, things are happening like that. So that's why United Independent, you understand, it is very, very easy for white people to get other non-white people to do their bidding, whether they know it or not. So all of that is to be expected, and you just have our code about how we go about our business to try to solve the problem.
Yes, sir. I remembered my last report. I have been listening to different reports on quote-unquote black-orientated news reports, talk shows, that sort of thing. And what I am anticipating in 2020 is a lot of debate, arguing amongst black people over the idea if the president retains his employment as president, that a lot of non-white black people will be blaming other non-white black people for this issue by stating that enough of us did not vote. I'm anticipating that because I'm hearing that on all of these different quote black orientated programs. And that's it. Thank you.
There was a hefty amount of Negro blame in 2016, saying that, you know, we were fully vested for President Obama both times, and then when he was no longer on the ballot, the lazy niggers again. Other folks, if we missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie.
Hello, and hello to everyone else listening and participating. I want to share something I realized that I really put myself in jeopardy, my safety in jeopardy, trying to protect some black children that were hanging out in a popular area. And with that said, I want to urge everyone, you know, as we call them, attempted parents, to talk to their children about being aware of where they're trying to hang out, if it's an area that is preferred by so-called white people, and advise them that you probably should not be in these areas because it could ultimately lead to any type of situation. And the situation that I was in was a lot of children, and it was quite a bit. It could have been about 40 of them were hanging out in a popular area after a festival event. The stuff was being taken down, and I saw them and spoke to them and saw that they were hanging around a homeless white lady that I had seen and talked to before. And I knew that the white lady was getting perturbed, and I saw other white people getting perturbed. And actually, one white lady, she was just staring at him, looking, you know, very scared. And, you know, I walked over to her to try to de-escalate her. I'm like, it's all good. They're just kids. You know, they're just playing around. Just, you know, don't freak out, you know. But she actually told me, she was like, I know they're kids, but that's not what I'm seeing, you know. So I urged the kids to leave. They did not listen to me. I don't know why, but they didn't listen to me. And I told them twice. I'm like, you need to go. So I tried to handle my business and come back out, and the situation escalated. And before I knew it, I interjected myself into the middle of it, trying to give them a chance to evade or escape. And I could have been harmed by a non-white, looked like Hispanic male, and his white male counterpart. But I think I did something kind of smart. I brought attention to myself and them and the proximity that they were trying to have on me, coming close to me by saying, hey, you all are not cops. You all don't have a badge. you don't need to be over here talking to me or these children. You need to just resume your job, taking your stuff down, and let it be. But they could have put their hands on me, and there were police out, and they were not intervening for the children or myself. They were just watching, and there was a white lady and her non-white friend. When it kind of did start to calm down, and there were three black girls that were trying to get their bikes off of a bike rack, and they walked over to these girls after they, you know, everybody basically was like, okay, we quit. And they walked over to the girls and started yelling at them. So I got in the middle of that as well, and I blocked them. I put myself in between them and the students. And I said, hey, are you all police? Do you have a badge? No, you don't. You don't have a right to be talking to these children. And I gave them a chance to leave. And we have to be codified in our thoughts, speech, and action, because it should not get to a point where anyone has to or is in the middle of a situation like that. And like I said, I don't know what could have happened. I don't know what these people had on their mind. It could have easily led to something bigger than what it was. And we just need to really be on our job as attempted parents and let our kids know, hey, listen, you can't be hanging out where white people like to hang out. You can't be in white neighborhoods passing out, you know, things for the school, because it can just go bad. And that really was on my head, what happened to those young men with that woman making them lie down at gunpoint. And I read later, right before the incident, I'm reporting how one of the boys, who's about 15 years old, told his grandmother, well, if I had died, I had made my peace with God. I was traumatized from that story, and then seeing what had happened that day, or seeing what was happening that day with these children, I'm like, I just don't want them to die. And, yeah, I guess I put my life on the line, didn't even think about it. And I'm not sure I'll do it again. Honestly, I don't think I will, because I have my own child that I have to be here for. So, you know, we got to really be honest with ourselves and our children, let them know we just can't do certain things until racism is eliminated, we're behind enemy lines. So that's all. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Irie. Behind enemy lines is metaphor. Wow. I'm sorry you had to experience that. That is commendable black self-respect to try to intervene, to try as best you can to keep these young victims safe. But just black babies cost less. Play that sound clip pretty frequently. And I mean, that just from what you described, sounds like it easily could have been a situation where they were harmed, where you could have been harmed just in a myriad of different ways. That is, I think that sort of thing, like what you articulated about, wow, I don't know if I would do this again. I'm an attempted parent myself. You know, in fact, I might not do this again if it happens, because I could have been harmed. I think that is exactly why Mr. Fuller, he recommends those type of situations. Something happens out in public where you didn't plan, like that wasn't a part of your agenda for the day. Like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have this conflict with these young children later on. I'm going to go out to defend them and, you know, some random white guy and whoever. Like, yeah, that was not on your agenda for the day. Something like that happens. At best, run. Maybe you try to tell them to run and write down some information about who was there so you can give a detailed report. But, I mean, I think he said, unless you're ready to die or do some killing, because that can happen so fast in the system of white supremacy. You got a gun culture, but you just have a violence and terrorism culture. They joke about killing people at the courthouse all the time. We hear that every workplace racism. Make jokes about killing folks for fun. White 10-year anniversary. What white people kill for fun?
Can I add something?
Yes,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You can finish. Okay. And I also forgot to mention, it was just it just really angered me because one of the children dropped their keys, and the white lady that was fussing at the girls while they were trying to leave, she ended up trying to argue with me after everything was done, and I turned my back, and that's when she goes, "Is this for one of your kids?" And I turn around, and it's a key on a lanyard that looks like it's for like a girl. I said, "Did you see one of the kids drop it?" She said, "Yeah, I did." I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, are you going to give me the key so I can give it back to that person, or are you going to continue to practice racism and dangling in my face?" And then that's when she kind of like took a breath, and then she took it out of her shirt. She had it on her neck, in her shirt, and she took it out of her shirt and off her neck, and then she gave it to me. It was really the dedication, as you say. It was wow. That's a metaphor too, but I don't know what to say about it. I was just stunned. Like I said, I don't want to experience that anymore.
So many layers of ugliness. Wow. Again, my apologies for having to endure all of that. And at minimum, I do think it's important to just, you know, hey, this could happen anytime where we choose to go out and intervene, even if it's a situation just for ourselves. This could happen. It could be, you know, it escalates. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. So just being as prepared as we can and just trying to make the best decisions possible. Yeah, that's, man, that is a tough one all the way. All I can say is, again, black self-respect, high commendations for trying to do the best that you could under very difficult situations, and wish they had listened the first time when you told them that maybe they should vacate. Man, other folks that we missed totally, if you have any thoughts, questions, suggestions you would like to share, if we missed you totally, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I kind of heard like bits and pieces of the audio segments. I think it was a portion where they were discussing about whether or not is racism a mental illness or something like that. Did they say a black male was conducting a study or something, Gus, in that part? Or
yes, sir. Dr. Carl Bell, he just died at the age of 71, but that was some of his work looking at whether or not whites who practice particularly violent acts of racism, is that some form of a mental illness?
Oh, okay. Thanks for the clarification on that, because that reminded me of the past couple of weeks with the unfortunate, what they call mass shootings. And I know that term mental illness was coming up, and that definitely sounds like codification when it comes to a white person committing an act of violence, and racism is essentially a part of it. And then video games were used, but you don't hear the person talking about video games whenever they write like a manifesto, or, you know, Dylann Roof saying he's well versed, I think, in racism. And I think it was a couple of years ago, I think the guy name was, what was the guy name? He had the phone call, Omar Thornton, I think that's what his name was. Like, nobody mentioned how racism affects people in that regard, or they don't even mention being a victim of mental illness and how abuse and things like that occur to black people, but they don't, white people, when I say they, white supremacists don't have high regard for black people and non-white people. And my last thing is, I don't know what might be the results of, I think the, I don't know, they're using the term trade war. That's interesting. If anybody's heard that on the news, trade war, and the president using the term enemy, and it seems to always be somebody non-white, because they use the word China. President Trump is against China, like a whole landmass of non-white people. And I don't know if that might be an act of counterwar, the non-white people in China saying, hey, you know, we're going to do what we do. We're going to respond. And they're doing something from their end, from their area of the world. And I just see mass codification, like, okay, so they're showing images on the news stations of white people doing a face palm. They have their face buried, I guess, or their hand is holding up their face to be more direct. And but I don't see them, like, criticizing him to the degree, like, to the degree where this person is just, you know, insert name-calling term. They still practicing racism, even though some people may call them a racist, but it doesn't seem like it would be if it were former President Obama. So I just wanted to really put focus on that. And really, that's all I have for now. But no, actually, I actually have one more thing. I was viewing one of it was a video on YouTube, and they have like these ads that pop up. So it was a tacky racist commercial ad. I think it was Gorilla Glue. So it's this black couple, and they were trying to fix some kind of an item, and this gorilla walks in and gives the black female, like a lighter complected female, the product, Gorilla Glue. And the way that they shot the image or the picture, it had in the background a blurred out image or a blurred out picture of the black male husband, and it had in the foreground the gorilla's arm handing the product to the wife. And the way it was shot and from that angle, it made it look like the arm was attached to the black male just for a few seconds. And then the image of the black male sharply is revealed on the commercial, and he says, oh, that's really clear. That's a good idea. So in my opinion, it made it look like they was calling him the gorilla. But that's all I wanted to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Niggers, apes, alligators, coons, and possums. Context of white supremacy, it never gets old. Calling or finding new creative and slick ways of calling black peoples monkeys, apes, gorillas. Much obliged, caller in Florida. I would say that is a distinct difference. President Obama had historic numbers of death threats. Kale Anderson's book, White Rage, Dr. Welsing talked about that all the time. The extraordinary, the historic levels of vitriol directed at President Obama. They can talk all they want about President Trump and the rhetoric, and some people call him a racist. I do not see the same level of threats and violent threats and name-calling directed at him as I did President Obama. Other folks, anybody we missed totally, have a hand up that we have not heard from at all thus far?
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto, yes, ma'am.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that at some point while I'm on the phone, it cuts out, and then I have to re-enter again. So I will just stay silent for now until everyone's gone through with their comments. Thank you.
Much obliged. Thank you for your perseverance in having to dial back in and press in the code and all those numbers. Hope you have an efficient phone to do all that easily. Let's see. make sure we didn't miss anyone. Make sure we don't have any folks who wait until the last 5 minutes. If you do have a comment, question you would like to share, counter racist suggestion, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I did see one report that I say weekly, I can't play everything. There was one report that was about, it was an inmate, LGBTQ issue again, so-called transgender inmate, and he was able to win, went to court. He won his case to get the prison authorities, I don't know if it's tax dollars, but to get the, what is it they call, gender confirmation. Words are so important. That's what they call it. Gender confirmation surgery. I think this was someone who originally was classified as a male and is now saying they want to be identified as a female and they want to get the so-called gender confirmation surgery, or they're going to get it. They just won their trial in first person where they got to get it. Even though they're in greater confinement, still got to get my gender surgery. Now, the first thing that I thought of in all of this was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Now, he was on death row, now in greater confinement, not death row in Pennsylvania, and still on deathbed, that's a metaphor, sorry, suffering from serious, nearly grave medical conditions and struggling to get medical attention that might prevent him or could prevent him from dying. And he's having a difficult time with that, but you can get gender confirmation surgery and apparently get someone else to pay for this. I don't think this is a procedure that costs, you know, two nickels or something. I think it might cost a little bit more. But I mean, what does that say in the system of white supremacy? Gender confirmation surgery, even if you are in greater confinement, I am about to die and I need medical treatment. I don't know. We'll get back to you tomorrow. We'll wait next. If you're still here next week, we'll think about it. If you need that gender confirmation, however, if you decide you no longer want to be a male, maybe we can move you ahead in the queue. Maybe I'm misinterpreting, but gender, contempt for gender, that's what Mr. Fuller says, enormous, as he said, changing everything. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, suggestions, to share last few moments before we wrap up. Proceed.
Hi, Gus, can you hear me okay?
Give us another sentence. Let's see.
Hello? Can you
yes,
hear
we
me?
Can hear you. Yes.
Oh, perfect. Yes, the other thing that I wanted to mention, it's from Toronto again. The other thing I wanted to mention is just a question. The whole question of equality. I've been hearing a lot about equality as of late in Canada. A lot of non-white, and particularly non-white black people, are mentioning about wanting equality. And I really question this because just reviewing the history alone, you know, my question is, who would ever want to be equal to the treachery that white people have done? I would not want to be equal to them, personally. What I would recommend for all listening is to really question, you know, how important is equality for you, and if equality should even be used, especially when compared to such a treacherous group of creatures. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto. That word equality, I hear that one regularly. The word race as well, I think that is a common tactic. As opposed to saying white supremacy racism, they will just say race. Be mindful of that as well, and I would say try to avoid continuing that pattern. That's what happens with language sometimes. We'll hear other people say race is the problem. We need to address race. racist been with us since 1619? It's white supremacy racism. It's not that we want equality. We don't want to be mistreated. We do not want white supremacy racism to be practiced against us. That is what we want. Whites are exemplary at using those type of words to obfuscate. So we're not really talking about the problem, their dedication to mistreating black people. Other folks, any other comments, questions they want to make sure they get in? Last few moments before we conclude. Grant, well,
may I be heard?
Check it. Oh, yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, just one quick thing. I think the term you used, was it conversion surgery? What was the term?
Gender confirmation surgery.
Okay, okay. There was a term being used around here locally on the news called conversion therapy. And I think it's along with that same type of category of talking about gender and surgical operations. And they had articles about banning it when it comes to young people and teenagers. So I guess it was around here in north central Florida. But yeah, it sounded like a very confusing term to me. Yeah, and it's called conversion therapy. They were banning conversion therapy. That's what they called it.
Have you heard?
Just one quick one, one quick second, Mr. Steele. My understanding of conversion therapy, that is supposed to be this procedure where if you have an individual who says that they are gay or LGBTQ, transgender, whatever it is, then this so-called conversion therapy is supposed to be a procedure where if I'm a parent or a teacher or someone and I say, oh, I'm concerned about this person who is, you know, confused about their sexual status, I'm going to get them conversion therapy. You were born a male and all of this, you know, talk about you feel like a female and all of that. That's incorrect. We're going to get you conversion therapy so that you will, you know, function correctly as a male and be attracted to other females. That's my understanding of what conversion therapy is. And there have been the LGBT groups. My understanding is they think that this is horrible and this is the worst thing. And they have been working apparently successfully in your area and many others to get that stopped so that they don't have conversion therapy anymore, and my understanding is that it is becoming less common. More and more places are doing away with it. LGBT rights, they have been super successful. Much obliged for your patience, Mr. Steele. Do you have a comment to get in?
Yeah. I was just going to say the same thing, that conversion therapy is whereby they I think they administer a series of psychological and coercive acts to get people who we now classify as LGBT to comport to a form of behavior that was seen as more normative at the time. So I don't know. What I don't understand is if they're allowed to subject children to hormone treatments to get them to stop their normal biological functions, such as puberty, I don't see why that is seen as legal, but subjecting the same children to classes and instructional programming and coercive tactics to get them to comport themselves to other desired behaviors, I don't see why that's legal but the conversion, so-called conversion therapy, is not. And along those lines, I was recently censured on one of my Facebook profiles for bringing up that so-called transgender people may have more success in arguing for special protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act, as opposed to trying to co-opt the Civil Rights Act for their agenda. And I wasn't banned for this, but I was censured. It was brought to my attention that such posting was not welcome on Facebook. And then I just want to say that, use this information however you want, but on Facebook, you can, it seems as though you are not allowed to speak disparagingly of any individual, be they real or fictional. I was recently, and one of my profiles was recently banned for 30 days because I made a joke about Blade, who's being played by I think his name is Marshall Ali. And I don't know how to say his first name, but I made a joke about the fact that he's going to be playing him, and Facebook removed the post. He's going to be playing the new Blade, I guess. And I made a joke about this, and Facebook removed the post, said that I was in violation of their standards for bullying, and it was a joke about a fictional character. So I just want to say that, if you see any suspected white supremacists who are speaking disparagingly of you personally, you can use the fact that Facebook is not taking kindly to any disparaging language directed at an individual, explicit insults, nothing like that. So you can use that information and get a lot of people, a lot of posts about you removed, and get a lot of people banned for that 30 days. Live by the sword, die by the sword. It happened to me, but it's very effective.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Live by the sword. That is a metaphor. Again, we will be here for the book club Thursday. Toni Morrison, Tar Baby, Area 8. Many folks' favorite area of people activity. Very happy to be reading Toni Morrison again, even though the circumstances. Much obliged to all the folks who participated. Do we have a final question? Folks need to make sure they get in before we conclude. Everyone satisfied? We'll assume everyone is grand for the evening. I will be sure to post the New York Times reports, the 1619 Project, if you're interested in reading. I did see some constructive information, and, it is the system of white supremacy, so you should also expect some things that do not make logical sense. Again, importantly, we are not victims of white supremacy waging war against non-white people, none of us. The system of white supremacy is war against non-white people. We are responding. This is counter-war, counter-racism. Get to say it again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let us preserve our brain computers, try to be as safe as we can. We don't need any extra toxins in our body. We have enough of that all over the universe, courtesy of white supremacists. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And when we are in a vehicle, when you're in the driver's seat, you are not on the cell phone. Again, just little things, the small things that we can control that might help us to just be a little bit safer, help minimize to some degree being stopped, terrorized, harassed by race soldiers, Daniel Pantaleo, when he moves to your town to protect and serve. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.